Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Well, that brings the curtain down on our little party. Hopefully Nicky Boy is sober enough to take over, but before I let him do his twisted thing, I want to wish you all a happy and safe upcoming holiday season. Rock on.
I'm back at you too, brah. Thanks for helping us out, my man. I appreciate that. High Voltage is a presentation of Westwood One, written and reduced by one Fred Lindgren, in studio production by Stephen Huggy Bear Cosio, Bomb Chicka Bomb, Executive Pimp Daddy is Norm Pattis. Tremendous concert material was supplied by Linkin Park and Warner Brothers Records. So big up yourself. Special thanks to Rob Goldklang as well. Don't forget to email your name and address to ww1highvoltage@gmail.com for your shot to win your own Road to Revolution set. Five-figure discount style. Free. 20 winners will be drawn totally at random on Friday, December 5th. So don't be a hump. Be part of the action. I'm Nick Carter. Peace out, bitches.
101.1 WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to the award-winning Nightfall, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Nightfall, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and triumphantly returning, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
I always do.
Yes. Feeling better this week, right?
I am.
Yeah.
Feeling great. Thank you.
Yeah. There weren't a lot of people that had the flu. You were one of the many. You were one of the few.
I've been pretty good this whole... I don't get flu shots or anything like that. I've been pretty good, but it got me. But I think it's a natural course that the human body should take once in a while.
Cleanse you out.
Yeah.
That's good. Hey, folks, this is a phone-in talk show. Our numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And for the bashful, and also if the lines are filled, which, let's see, they are not right now, call talkyes@yahoo.com. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. There'll be a podcast up and ready to listen to by noon tomorrow on Monday. So check that out. There's a MySpace page. There's a Facebook page. Are you and Debbie checking that out? I mean, are we getting friends and all that?
You know, we have a lot of friends.
Yeah?
Actually, yeah.
I don't know what the hell that means, but that's good.
It means they get the updates and the podcasts right through Facebook.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay. Hey, go to it if you're into that. Well, things are still kind of getting bad, aren't they?
In which way?
Every which way. 600,000 jobs lost last month.
Oh, economy, yeah.
Yeah, this is the result. I mean, why are the Democrats compromising at all with the Republicans? These are the people that essentially, let me put it completely without ambiguity. The Republicans enacting out Reaganomics are essentially who brought us to this abyss, or at least to the lip of the abyss. Hopefully we're not going to fall totally into an abyss. And the Democrats, from time to time, did their enabling as well, and both in terms of cooperating, often just out of timidity, and they wanted to look bipartisan, or they at times represented corporate interests, but certainly they didn't act as the tough opposition party that I guess they really haven't been in modern times in the last 40 or 50 years. They've always crumpled. Now they've got this overwhelming majority. They essentially have a mandate. I mean, George Bush, and let's let's go for the legal thing. I mean, I always say, you know, that Bush stole both the 2000 and 2004, but giving him, it's hard for me to do, the benefit of the doubt that he actually won. It was, well, he lost the popular vote in 2000 and just squeaked through in 2004, and he ruled like he had a mandate.
Right? Oh, yeah, sure he did.
So the Democrats ought to do that as well. These Republicans have screwed up everything, and all these rich guys who they represent have screwed up everything. So they ought to just go for what they think would be best, and if they can't get all the votes, say, you know, you need 60 votes and all that, say they only wind up with 58, and that means that the stimulus bill is going to stall. Well, the American people that are at the abyss personally in terms of their finances, have lost a job or fearful of losing a job, losing their health insurance, seeing their pension or their 401ks go down the drain, they are then going to look at these people who have learned nothing, who still see themselves, the Republicans, that is, as this vibrant, strong-willed opposition party. Stronger will.
Those aren't the words I would use.
Oh, they're hideous, horrible people that have no concern for the average person. I don't even think they have concern for the rich people that they traditionally represent. They simply are after political power.
Yeah, kind of thing.
It's the pathology of power with these folks. But right now, you and me, and I could mean either me and Jolene or any of you listening, we are these quiet spectators hoping that the elites are going to do something that doesn't screw things up worse or stop what's happening, stop the bleeding.
That's really kind of what people are saying these days. Well, it's either, I sure hope it gets better, or do you think it's going to get better? You know, that's really where everyone kind of is right now.
And hope, although I know that a lot was made of the
hope.
Of hope, the audacity of hope. Well, I don't think hope, and that's the name of Barack Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope. I don't think that hope, being hopeful, is very audacious at all. It's a very, very passive emotion.
True. You know, it really is.
Like when you you go for some tests to the doctor and you hope that they come back.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, but it doesn't have anything to do with the outcome. Or you're going off on a picnic and you hope it doesn't rain. You don't affect it. Well, here's how people in France responded to the economic downturn there. They did a general strike. Trains, buses, airports, hospitals, schools, offices closed or in limited service. People everywhere talk about the economic crisis, but the French, in their way, are doing something about it. France has come to a near standstill for a one-day general strike. The CBC's, this is Canada, David Common reports from Paris. So this is from CBC. Hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets, protesting that banks, not people, are being bailed out and decrying President Nicolas Sarkozy's cost-cutting moves as unemployment creeps towards 10%, which is happening here as well. The CBC's comments that today is being called Black Thursday here in France, and with good reason. Here's just a partial list of the things that are closed or in limited service. The metro, buses, trains, airports, hospitals, schools, government offices, post offices, the list goes on. Thierry de Deux, a leader of one of the country's major...
Sounded French.
Yeah, well, to you. The major labor groups, the Confédération Française Démocratique du Travail...
What are you getting at, Peter?
Put the protesters' view this way. We want to show that people are dissatisfied at the moment. We don't want to have to pay for a crisis that we're not responsible for.
Well, I like how they do it over there in France. And I told you, I've talked about it on this show before. I've been there in the middle of one of the big protests. And I tell you that something like that really... We need to get out there and do something.
Yeah, now I'm surprised someone isn't calling and saying, well, if we shut everything down, that's going to make everything worse. Well, one of the things...
Well, how about one thing at a time?
Yeah, well, here is the deal. This isn't just, we're mad as hell and we're going to strike out blindly. Working people, white collar and blue collar in France, are represented by trade unions, and they have very specific demands. Mm-hmm. Those are formulated so that the people that did not cause all of this, that's us, everyone listening, maybe 1% of you, but maybe 100% of us didn't cause it, and there's no reason that we should be carrying the load, suffering the worst.
Oh, yeah, and as costs continue to increase, and even things like, in where we live, the water went up 7%.
Yep.
the gas prices are, as far as heating oil go, are out of control. My next door neighbor said her bill was $350.
For water?
For gas.
Oh, for gas, sorry.
Yeah, and she doesn't have a large house.
I'm sorry, I drifted for a second.
Yeah. Well, it was, water's, yeah.
Water's
gone up.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Well,
so how are people supposed to do it?
Now, the Obama administration is imposing a cap of $500,000 for top executives at companies that receive large amounts of bailout money. Executives would also be prohibited from receiving any bonuses from their above their base pay, except for normal stock dividends. Which
this
of course,
thing is not going to fly.
You know, this is, I mean, this stimulus package.
That portion of it, what he's calling for.
Well, why don't they receive, let me see, think, how about nothing?
Yeah.
I mean, these guys are so wealthy anyway.
They deserve a little.
No. Well, they got it all. They've got it all for the
already?
Last. Yeah, for the last year has gone by. Some of these guys that were at these failing financial institutions, of course, received millions and millions, tens of millions in some cases,
yeah,
and they have personal fortunes worth tens of millions. Why, almost as a gesture, because they're going to remain wealthy in the face of people that are suffering so badly, that have had all their life plans just thrown to the ground, and the anxiety that almost everyone, when you go up to anyone almost and say, are you fearful of about your job? You know, they'll, almost everyone says, yeah, I am. Are you fearful,
yep,
that your, medical could be,
you're
going to
lose
up
your house, medical. And meanwhile, I read the article in the New York Times about welfare,
yeah,
that it's not increasing as
it's decreasing.
As the economy drops off. It's not going up. You would think it does. And there was something in there that really got to me. It was about, you know, some people choose to feel like they should help people through,
yeah,
hard times. And some just think that it's only, enabling people not to work. It's like conservatives think that, you know, it enables them not to work and not to get married or whatever. It's just such a bunch of a hooey.
Yeah, like I haven't heard anybody in a long time. Anybody can find a job if they want one. Why don't they retrain?
Well, listen.
For what?
And I know people in my life who have been trying to get a job for a long time.
That's
and
right.
They're having a very difficult time, and it's frustrating.
And part of the problem is that everything, you know, there's always this debate. I was talking about it last week about, is this overproduction or underconsumption? You think, well, isn't it about the same? I mean, that there are these huge inventories. For instance, we know the car companies had.
Yeah.
That's why people didn't come back. They didn't have people. They had people on furlough for so long. But how about this? Cell phone sales are falling. Manufacturers have announced thousands of layoffs, and wireless carriers are finding it harder to acquire and keep customers. It seems like another tale of recession bites industry, but there are signs that this downturn is masking something more fundamental, that the cell phone industry's best days are behind it.
Yeah. People aren't able to afford it anymore.
Well, also, the market is saturated.
Oh, so isn't it?
There's 3 billion people with cell phones.
Wow.
And it's me, like, and poor people in third world countries that don't have one.
Right. You're about it.
That's it.
I mean, even this guy we work with together, who's,
yeah,
is kind of like old school, taking it old school, finally got a cell phone, Peter.
Really?
Yeah, you're the last.
Does his slogan begin with a B?
No, he's tall and skinny.
Okay.
He even got one.
This is a call from far away, so let me get her. And it's Dawn in Gulfport, Mississippi. Dawn, thanks for calling Night Call.
Yes, I got a call today from someone up near Lansing.
Yeah.
And they said that they were closing like 2 to 3 women's prisons up there.
Really?
Do you have any idea, Peter, which ones they are?
I didn't know they were.
I haven't heard that.
They have 2 or 3 women's prisons in Michigan?
Yes, and she said it was on the news. This lady said it was on the news, and I'm not up there.
Well, Dawn, you're calling from pretty far away.
Where are you calling from?
Gulfport,
Mississippi.
Oh.
I mean, what's the interest here?
I have a daughter in the system.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So she's due to soon come out, but I just was wondering if you knew which ones they were, because where she just come from, they didn't have, well, where she's at, they're having a big problems with black mold, 14% lead in the water, no heat.
Oh, no.
No, they're terrible. Yeah. And also, there's all these female inmates sued the state of Michigan because there had been so many sexual assaults on women prisoners.
There's something that I just looked up that says the Robert Scott Correctional Facility in Wayne County's Plymouth Township will close in May of this year. But do you have computer access?
Yes.
You know what I would do is I would go to google.com and then put in women's prisons in Michigan to close, and I'm sure you'll find more than, you know, I only have a couple minutes here, but there are things on there to look up.
All right.
Okay. And is your email WRIE.com or
it's call talk yes.
Excuse me?
It's call talk yes.
Call talk yes.
@yahoo.com.
Yahoo.com. Okay, thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, Dawn.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, yeah.
We hope the conditions improve for your
daughter. How would she know to call this show about an informational question? I mean, that's fine.
Word gets around, Peter.
Yeah. Here, the stimulus bill working its way through Congress is not just a package of spending increases and tax cuts intended to jolt the nation out of recession, says the New York Times. For Democrats, it's also a tool for rewriting the social contract with the poor, the uninsured, and the unemployed in ways they have long yearned to do. I'm not sure I like the tone of this, but the idea that we take care of everybody in this society makes a lot of sense. With little notice or no public hearings, House Democrats would create a temporary new entitlement allowing workers getting unemployment checks to qualify for Medicaid, the health program for low-income people. Spouses and children could also receive benefits no matter how much money the family had. I mean, in other words, if they were laid off. In addition, the stimulus package would offer a subsidy to help laid-off workers retain the same health plans they had from their former employers. If you don't like the idea of that, let me read the last sentence here. Altogether, the economic recovery bill would spend $127 billion over the next 2.5 years to individuals and states for health care alone, a fact that has Republicans fuming.
No, I'm sure.
Fuming.
And foaming at the mouth.
That the stimulus package is a backdoor to universal health coverage. Oh, my Gaia.
Not that.
Oh, my Gaia.
Thing that might help you and I. All of us.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, here, by the way, this is from Carol. Carol writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and this is from hr676.org, and hr676.org. And here, she's to check out some of the tremendous benefits that National Health Insurance, which is the House of Representatives Bill 676, will bring, and see what you think. Every resident of the U.S. will be covered from birth to death. No more pre-existing conditions to be excluded from coverage. No more expensive deductibles or copays.
Hmm.
Am I getting everybody with this? All prescription medications covered. All dental and eye care included. Mental health and substance abuse care fully covered. Long-term and nursing home services included. You can always choose your own doctor and hospital. Cost of coverage will be assessed on a sliding scale basis. I don't get that. I thought it was all free. Anyway. Tremendously simplified system of medical administration, and your coverage is not tied to any job or location. Existing Medicare benefits for those over 65 will remain the same or be vastly improved in many cases. No corporate bureaucrat will ever come between you and your doctor to deny you care.
Wow.
Who's opposed to that? Anybody? 313-298-WRIF, Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. But you know what, Carol? This ain't a-gonna happen. The money has all gone up in smoke to the Iraq war and now to Barack Obama's Afghan war.
And not to be negative, that's being real.
Yeah, that's real. Some of the money we could have gotten with an excess profits tax, like on ExxonMobil, who made $45 billion in profit, and could have had a bill that could have taken about $40 billion from the company and left the stockholders with a measly $5 billion to split among themselves. That's really terrible. 313-298-WRIF says the colleges are going to do well. And if you listen at 1 a.m. today, Eastern Time, I guess that'd be tomorrow, wouldn't it?
That would.
That would be. That I'm going to interview somebody who has written a book called, let me grab this here real quickly because the book's kind of got a long title. The Student Loan Scam, the Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. There's hundreds of billions of dollars out in student loans.
Yeah.
There's 5 million people are in default, and this could be the next bubble to go down.
Oh, for sure. Yep.
So,
TikTok.
Why don't we have free higher education in this country? We all say it's so important. It's important to the individual. It's important to our nation. It's important to every part of our society you can imagine. Because you know why? Because we spent trillions of dollars making war. Not just the Iraq war, not just the Afghan war.
Yeah, which is...
But the continuing...
A mess.
Yeah, the continuing war. The continuing wars. All right, let's see. Let's get some calls. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Here is Pamela. Pamela is in Romulus.
Every part of our society can imagine, because you know why?
That sounds like me.
Turn your radio down.
Well, I'm going to put you on hold. Roger, explain this
to her.
We'll
come back.
Please. Yeah. Here is Ernie. Ernie's in Ann Arbor. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
We're doing good.
First-time caller, I've been listening to your program for the last few months. I retired back in June. I took the buyout from General Motors. I've been there for 32 years.
Wow.
And, you know, they offered this buyout to, you know, kind of help them themselves to bring the lower wage in. And, you know, I mean, I started out at $4.95 when I hired in '76. So, you know, I mean, I can understand the way things are and,
but you mean you're talking about the UAW agreed to a two-tier wage where the new hires are being brought in at half the wage.
Correct.
$14 an hour, yeah. Yeah.
Correct. But I mean that's better than some of the jobs that are out there for $7-$9 an hour.
Yeah, well, come on, but Ernie, that you and your parents' generation fought for 40 or 50 years to get a middle-class standard of living, it's going back the other way.
Yeah, I understand that, but, you know, I mean, it's like they're picking on the auto workers to do that, and we did our job. We took a dollar that we were supposed to get a couple of years ago, an hour. We did away with that, so that's $40 an hour or $40 a week, you know, for 40 hours. So you figure that's, 160 a month,
right,
times 12 months. I mean, we did our share of helping the company out, and the big shots have just, you know, brought us down to the level they want us to be.
You got it. But you know what? I think it was a mistake for the UAW ever to give back anything.
Oh, you're correct about that, Peter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we've gave enough back, and you know, the way Madoff has done with his $50 million and the way the Bush administration has destroyed our economy, it's just a bunch of crap.
Yeah. Well, all right. Good luck, and I hope your retirement is an enjoyable one after 32 years.
Yeah.
Ernie, you deserve
it. Jeez, sure do.
Hats off to Ernie. Now, there are people that have fought back historically, that have went to lengths to create the basis for a middle class in this country. It's under erosion right now, and we have a caller on the line, I believe. Al, are you with us?
I am, Peter. How are you?
Hi, and you're calling from where?
I'm calling from Southfield.
Okay, Al's on the line, and he's going to tell us about sit-down strikers bringing their story of victory and resistance to Detroit. It's been done in the past. It's been done in the recent past, and we can get some ideas of what's possible. Tell people what I'm talking about, Al.
Well, Peter, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at IBEW Local 58, we're going to host the Republic Window and Door Set Down Strikers. Recently, the company that they work for announced that they were going to shut down their plant. And when you shut down a plant, there are some residual benefits that accrue to that. They weren't paid their WARN notice benefits. They weren't paid any of their shutdown benefits. They weren't even paid their wages and any health insurance that they had contractually coming. So when that happened, those workers sat down in their plant, occupied the plant, and stayed in the plant for 6 days, and ultimately were successful in getting all of their residual benefits.
It really shows and, what happens when you fight back.
Exactly right. And although the workers tomorrow would like to have people come out and tell them personally, I can tell you that not only did they succeed in getting all their benefits, but as a result of that fight, their union, the United Electrical Workers, was able to find a buyer for that plant, and that plant's going to operate.
Hmm.
Wow.
Well, that's a success story. Now, this sit-ins and sit-downs have a long history in the labor movement. In fact, going back to the late 1930s when the UAW was formed, and lo and behold, that some veterans of 70 years ago are going to join you guys, and perhaps me if I can get away, because I'd sure like to see all this down at the IBEW Local 58 Hall. And tell us about these veterans of the 1930s that are going to be there.
Well, I hope you're there, Peter, because we're going to host veterans of the 1937 Flint sit-down strike. There are a couple of veterans. They're in their 90s now. They're still vital. They're vibrant reminders of the thing that built the union movement in our state and our country. People that sat down in their plant for 44 days in the winter of 1936 into 1937, and ultimately got the first contract between General Motors and the United Auto Workers. And they'll be joining us, and we'll be honoring them.
All right, well, just hearing you, because I actually have this I don't think matters in the scheme of things. I have an enormous number of things to do over the next couple of days, and I was thinking, I don't think I can get away. But, Al, you've sold me on this, because the idea that we are all just victims of this heartless, anonymous economic system with no chance to fight back is just a misconception. And when people get together, when people do things in concert, particularly resistance, boy, sometimes we win.
Well, we've been spoon-fed that you can't fight back, that demonstrations don't matter, that mass movement is inconsequential over the last 15 or 20 or maybe 30 years. And, you know, we know if we study history that that's wrong. But we know that if we just look at what happened in Chicago last month, we know that that's wrong as well.
Okay.
If people stand up and fight back, people can win. And if you don't fight back, you're guaranteed that you're going to lose.
Yeah, and interestingly, at this plant in Chicago, when workers occupied the plant at Republic Windows and Doors for 6 days, everybody under the sun came and supported them, including Barack Obama.
Well, it was a major turn in American political awareness. It was something that I'm sure many of us did not expect, but that's correct. Barack Obama said that he supported these workers and that they were doing what they needed to do to get what they had coming. So that was refreshing, that was exciting, and that just should fuel the fire for people to learn to fight back. And frankly, I got to tell you, we're going to host those workers tomorrow at the United Steelworkers District so that other workers in the Metro Detroit area who are affected by plant shutdowns or on long-term layoffs can join those workers and talk about their own struggles, learn from the United Electrical Workers' struggles, and learn ways to fight back. Because Peter, I know that you know that the United Steelworkers are a fighting union. You, I'm sure, are paying attention to what Leo Gerard, our president, is doing in the media.
Sure.
And we organized 10,000 steelworkers to go out and make sure that Barack Obama got elected. But that's not the only way that we organize workers. We have organized workers in Canada to take over plants for the same type of situations. And we will teach workers and we will learn with workers and we will participate with workers to fight back and to build a movement that fights that fight on all the fronts,
and you know,
electoral and in the streets and in the factories.
And, you know, see, we're in a period where the vast majority of working people are not in unions, yet the United Steelworkers actually has a formation for people that are not formerly members of trade unions.
That's correct. People can join the United Steelworkers as associate members and become part of our fighting movement to organize workers.
Well, I want to thank you so much for bringing this to our attention, and I'll just repeat it again. There's going to be a workers' victory rally with the sit-down strikers from Chicago and also from the historic victory in Flint to celebrate these and support also the Employee Free Choice Act as well. It's going to be tomorrow, 6 p.m. at the IBEW Local 58 Hall. It's downtown Detroit, 1358 Abbott. If you're driving or you're just not getting this real quickly, you can go to my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, PeterWerbe.com, and on the left side, you go down a little bit, there's a silhouette of the city of Detroit. Click on that, it'll bring you to the calendar, and it'll give you all the information on that and other events as well. Al, I'll see you at the IBEW Hall tomorrow night at 6 p.m.
Thank you, brother.
All right, brother. Thank you very much. I do like that aspect of the union movement. We call each other brother,
brother,
sister.
They're brothers and sisters. Yes.
Sister Julie?
Yes, brother Peter.
All right. Let's see. Here's Dave in Redford. Open lines, by the way, 313-298-WRIF. Dave, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just, on Alaska, I'd like to see some of that effort in solidarity against, what our government is doing to us, not just against what, the supposed evil businesses are doing, but, besides that, I mean, what kind of profit margin is Exxon making? I mean, you say they make so much money, but I mean, aren't they investing quite a bit of money to make all that money?
No.
No.
I mean,
how do you figure?
Well, they're not investing enough money. If they had enough refineries, don't you understand this? If they actually used it for expanding their industrial facilities, they could have refine enough gasoline that gasoline wouldn't be as high as it is. But if gasoline wasn't as high as it was, they wouldn't make $45 billion. I mean, why have any tender mercy for these people, Dave?
No, I mean, but seriously, what is their profit margin? Does that matter?
It doesn't matter much to me. It probably matters to the stockholders, but they're doing quite well. I mean, I don't think anybody disputes that they've been gouging their consumers, that it's a monopoly, which we thought we got rid of like 100 years ago or something like that. And they have the ability to, you know, they have this, you know, vertical monopoly where they control all aspects of production, and they can pretty much screw us any way they want. And then you see in a period where you would think that their profit margin should remain the same, that it accelerates enormously. That gives you the clue that they're ripping us off. Well, let's rip back.
What should the price be? I mean,
well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what your point is.
I liked $1.50.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, you could make some arguments that if you put everything together, that gasoline should be $6 a gallon because of the, you know, what infrastructure costs and that the government facilitates, you know, their product and all that. But what I'm getting at and what I'm wondering about, you seem to have some tender concern for these people that under any other, under a just system belong in jail.
Under a just system, frankly, half our government belongs in jail, and this is the people you want to run our health care.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure who you're talking about now. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but then I would agree with you like a month and a half ago or something like that, and I still hope that the people that were in the last government, they richly deserve to be in jail for the many crimes they've committed. I'm not a big fan of government, but right now the nature of society is so enormously complex. We're all tied into it in a intricate way, and we're just about to go down the drain. So we better hope that Barack Obama has got a team together that's a bit better than these thieves and incompetents that ruined our lives over the last 8 years.
Certainly, but with his initial nominations and whatnot, that doesn't seem to necessarily be the case.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there does seem to be among all bureaucrats and government people this the sense that somehow they are different, and the fact that they blew off these people that felt they didn't have to pay taxes is a good thing. But I'm not sure where you're going with this. Let's go back to ExxonMobil. Here are these people that demonstrably stole. Ripped us off, highway robbery, made people's life most miserable. The people that, whose lives were made the most miserable were the people that could afford it the least. And I'm saying we ought to get back about $40 billion of it. Do you think that's a good idea?
Sure, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac when they're coming.
Okay, all right, I can tell. Typical conservative cannot stay on question. I don't know what it is, man, but have a good one. All right, we've got some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Before you go, remember there's a guy here that works. You know, and if you say
a guy we work with who's conservative,
yeah,
and goes on, it diverts to another.
Yeah, always. And if you say, I'm trying to think about something. If you say, you know, well, Bush lied about the war in Iraq. And
but what about Clinton? And that's what he does.
Or even worse, he'll say, what about Chavez in Venezuela?
Oh yeah, well he's on you like big time for that. He's in L.A. right now.
Good. Let him stay. Now, if you're listening, we love you.
We love you.
No, we don't.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Leave us to 101 WRIF to celebrate our birthday.
And 38 years of rock history.
By giving all the presents to you.
This is Drake Wolf from Green Day.
This is Brian Johnson of AC/DC.
Hey, what's up? This is Brendan Chinedown.
This is Papa Hef from Metallica.
Hello, Motor City. This is Mike Creed from Pearl Jam.
Hi, this is Gene Simmons of Kiss.
Hey, everyone. This is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters.
Riff rocks.
Detroit's legendary home of rock and roll. Celebrates 38 years of rock in the Motor City.
You've made the riff what it is for all these years.
So, to say thank you, WRIF is giving you the stuff that you just can't get anywhere else. Listen to win awesome pieces of rock history.
Like a vinyl copy of Eliminator, autographed by ZZ Top. A Black Keys signed lithograph. Or a photo card signed by Zakk Wylde.
Along with a pair of VIP passes to WRIF's 38th anniversary bash, February 13th at Amnesia Ultra Lounge inside Motor City Casino Hotel.
Celebrating 38 years of rock history. WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Take two authentic. WRIS streaming live on your iPhone 3G.
It's the most powerful force in the universe!
Well, it is pretty sweet. Just hit the iTunes Store to download your free WRIF app. It connects you to the Riff with just one touch. Details at WRIF.com. The Real Riff.
So this year, I won't spend Valentine's Day in the doghouse.
Sure, you say that every year.
No, really, this is the year I'll get it right.
You mean Gwen didn't like the ab buster you got her last year for Valentine's Day?
Oh, don't remind me. This year, it's under control. I've got a great idea for a gift. The perfect movie to rent, and I'm even thinking of cooking a romantic dinner.
Seriously, how are you going to put all that together?
Easy, I'm heading to MotorCityValentines.com. I found gift ideas Gwen actually will like. Lists of romantic songs, films, and recipes that even I can cook.
MotorCityValentines.com. Sounds like it's a one-stop Valentine's Day headquarters for guys like us.
Dude, are you kidding me? Even my dad and brother log on to MotorCityValentines.com for ideas that would keep them out of the doghouse this year.
MotorCityValentines.com is brought to you in part by Vinter's Cellar in Royal Oak, Elements Therapeutic Massage in North Novi, New You Body Wraps, and Dream Dinners. Make it a Valentine's Day to remember at MotorCityValentines.com.
Want to stand out from your colleagues and increase your career options? Check out Oakland University. OU offers nearly 100 graduate programs in the hottest fields, including master's degrees and short-term certificates to quickly retool your credentials. At OU, you'll learn directly from expert faculty members and have countless opportunities for research and industry experience. You'll gain respect from employers, colleagues, and family members alike. Plus, research shows those with master's degrees enjoy higher pay, increased employee benefits, and a better work-life balance than their peers without this credential. Don't miss our graduate student open house Wednesday Thursday, February 11th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. in the Oakland Center on the campus of Oakland University in Rochester, just minutes from I-75 and M-59. That's Wednesday, February 11th. Call 248-370-3167. That's 248-370-3167. Or on the web at oakland.edu/gograd. Distinguish yourself with a master's degree from Oakland University.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. And Jalene, I am not going to ask you.
What?
Never mind.
Oh, about that commercial?
Never mind.
People who are listening online have no idea what we're about.
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. Open lines.
And our email is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Have you been checking that?
I need to do that.
Okay.
Good idea.
This,
we're too busy listening to the commercials.
Right. A commission tonight, overwhelmingly, this, let me see, was February 4th, rejected a proposal to make English the official language of Macomb County, a plan that would have banned county providers from offering services in multiple languages. The county's charter commission, a group charged with revamping county government, voted 25-1 to quash the proposal. Some right-wing nut job, of course, was behind it all, didn't want the county's health department and other providers from handing out multilingual pamphlets and hiring employees to communicate to non-English speakers. And Democratic Charter Commissioner James Massaroni said of the proposal, it's repugnant and offensive to present It's repugnant and offensive to present-day immigrants and past immigrants. Now, the Massaronis are everywhere. Judge Peter Massaroni was connected up to the Macomb County Court, and some kid escaped from jail, blasted through a wall, and then they found him hiding. He got into Judge Massaroni's car and was hiding in the trunk.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah. So
the
Massaronis are this great family from Macomb County.
Wow, I missed
them,
that little
and
tidbit.
Some of them
That's
listen,
horrible.
Some of them listen to Night Call. So, hi, Massaronis.
Hello.
Yeah, yeah. For some reason or other, let me see, what was the guy who, what's his name, Audet? I can't see his first name here. Oh, Harry Audet. He introduced the proposal by reciting the beginning of the Pledge of Allegiance in Spanish. Said the idea was to encourage immigrants to learn English. You know, I don't know where he came from, but don't you think back then there were these people who had already been here or were from the British Isles who were saying, I know those oddies, unless he was, you know.
It's just a very white thing. And, you know, it just shows what state he lives in or what area he lives in. Because if you live in California, you know, this guy would be miserable.
Well, what happens is people come over here. They don't know the language. Most of our relatives or our ancestors, and unless they were from the British Isles, you know, they spoke German or French or Russian or Italian or Yiddish or Chinese or whatever. And by the time the second generation is around, mm-hmm. they're saying to their parents, Mom, speak English, you know,
uh-huh.
and they're, you know, the old folks are trying to keep like the ethnic
the
ghetto
culture.
Together. Yeah. And by the third generation, they're indistinguishable. So, but these, I mean, here at the end, let's see, The charter commissioners weren't convinced, saying more important issues face the county, such as creating jobs and building a new government that is good for all residents. Do you think? Well, you wonder where our money goes and why in the wealthiest country in the world we're still just flailing around trying to get enough money to finance what we need to put everything back on track. Well, in this town called Beni Souef, Egypt, the United States spends a lot of money in Egypt. It gives Egypt about $1.7 billion in cash aid annually. How about
wow.
if we cut them off entirely? Let's see if we can get I can see pretty well here, but let's get a show of hands. How many people want to give Egypt $1.7 billion a year? Ooh. Uh-oh, wait, no. No, that guy was just scratching the top of his head. All right. Most of it goes to purchase weapons and support the military. That's a good idea, right? Let's arm everybody.
Yeah, which we are doing.
Yeah, right.
They are doing.
There's also a huge United States embassy in Cairo, second in size only to the new one in Iraq, filled with diplomats, military officers, FBI agents, drug enforcement agents, CIA agents, and more.
And probably a Starbucks or two.
Yeah. So that probably costs a few more billion. The United States also spent about $2,000 over 2 years to teach Yusra Youssef to speak English. She's a 15-year-old from Asyut, A-S-Y-U-T, one of the most conservative tradition-bound cities in this country, once an incubator for Islamic extremism. Officials in Washington were a bit angry at how much it costs to teach Ms. Youssef. Because in other countries, the same program costs about $1,000 a student. You get this? We are spending hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars to teach people in other countries to speak English.
Now, yeah, but don't do it here.
What about sending, here, old Republican Charter Commissioner Harry Audet, how about taking this money and teaching people that probably would like to learn English in Macomb County, and that would serve a couple of birds with one stone.
And you can quit bitching while you're at it, right?
Oh, man. What is with these people?
An email, the brothers and sisters who are laborers in higher education in Tennessee send their greetings of solidarity north to the folks gathering tomorrow night, and they're going to have their own action tomorrow. They're listening in Tennessee.
They are. Actually, if those people could call in, that would be great because they're having some big job action.
It's a funeral for higher education, that one.
Yeah.
Held on the state steps of the state capitol before the governor's state of the state address.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So people are beginning to organize. You got to remember that in the last depression, that it was...
are you calling this a depression officially?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I think it is.
Even Ryan Seacrest called it a depression on the Grammys tonight.
Uh-oh.
Well, the E! Network's calling it a depression.
Aren't we heading up towards like 10% unemployment in Michigan? And remember, people keep saying this is like 1929. Unfortunately, it is. And when it really got terrible was like by 1930, 31, 32. So that's what Barack Obama and the Democrats are trying to do. In the meantime, the Republicans are just trying to think, how can we get more money to the banks and the financial institutions and give more tax breaks to the wealthy? Everything that caused all of this in the first place.
Speaking of Republicans, we had a caller who you figured out on your very own, I don't know how, just kidding here, that he was a Republican. And we got an email from Steve who said, hi, guys. I think that caller was confused. The $45 billion is net profit.
Yeah.
That means money left after all of your expenses, not gross profit. Republicans never get it, Steve says.
Well, and again, is what I said. They could have taken some of that $45 billion and used it to do more refining. Or they could have just said, people are hurting in this country, and we're not going to take such a big profit margin. Although we could put up the prices anywhere we want, we could put it up over $4 a gallon. We're going to self-limit ourselves to have a certain limit on the profit taking.
Mark in Columbus, Michigan.
Yeah.
I think unless it's Missouri and he says MI, but I'm thinking it's Michigan.
It's Michigan.
Says you really got smoked by that guy.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Yeah. All right.
Please tell us what you mean.
Missouri is M.O.
Is there a Columbus, Michigan?
Yeah, yeah. That's
okay.
where
he's calling from.
That's where he, I haven't heard from him in a long time.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. All right. He's a whole family of right-wingers.
Oh, so you know who this is.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought he was being facetious, but I guess not.
No.
He didn't get smoked by that guy.
Whatever. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jeff in Oxford. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. The reason I was calling was basically to touch upon what you were speaking about earlier about socialized medicine, or where the government would pretty much cover the cost for everybody, regardless of your job or if you're working or not. And I think that it really could be summed up to one word. The reason why you would really never see that happen, that'd basically be the AMA, which is pretty powerful. And I think that would really stonewall any type of, ceiling on pay that a physician would make, either surgeon or practitioner in internal medicine. They make a lot of money if you compare that to the salaries you see over in Europe or any other country. And I don't think they would allow something like that to occur, even though it's into the best interest of, you know, everybody here in the United States.
Well, you know, Jeff, actually the phrase socialized medicine was devised by publicists for the AMA, the American Medical Association, back in the 1940s when Harry Truman, after World War II, first proposed it. Because, as we've said so many times before, every industrialized country in the world other than the United States has a government health program that sees it as a right, as a matter of citizenship, that it's you know, it's so important to our well-being. And I don't know. I mean, I think you could have a mixed system where it's not a thing where you say, okay, all you doctors are going to make $45,000 a year or $145,000. I think that doctors in other countries, if I'm correct, and got to remember back from this is a poor source, but from Sicko, you know, Michael Moore's film, which is a pretty good film. But like I always tell people, you got that films and videos aren't always the best source of information. But I don't know that I'm not sure what the AMA's position on a socialized medicine is. Maybe other people know and could tell us.
I just think that they would be more prone to avoid this, because what happens is usually, just like with Medicare, when a patient gets a set amount for a procedure,
yeah,
that's ultimately going to cut into, I mean, a doctor isn't for business. And unfortunately, I think not all, and it's hard to, you know, speak for every physician out there, surgeon or practitioner in the ambulatory setting. I think you see it as, I mean, they're out to make money.
Sure.
I don't think a majority of your physicians are going into that profession because of the love and compassion for humankind. I think a lot go in there for stature, you know, the MD at the end of their name, and also, you know, the money. I mean, you couldn't find me a physician that would say, okay, I'll do this job for, you know, $80,000 a year, you know.
Well, you know, what might occur would be a new breed of doctors. I mean, that's happened in other countries, that people do just have the commitment to the core values of what it means to be a doctor. You know, by the way, let me just go back to what I was saying about how the PR firm devised this phrase, socialized medicine. That might, I'm sure it doesn't have it doesn't probably have any power now whatsoever. But in the 1940s into the 1950s, anything that even had the word socialism or something like that sounded like something that had come from Moscow. So, people say socialized medicine. Oh, I'm not for socialized medicine. But if you really look at the core of the word, what they're talking about is socializing the cost, just like we have socialized police, and we have socialized the fire departments, and we have, you know, stuff.
Yeah.
We have socialized road building, because the individuals can't take it on. It's necessary to collect taxes and then transfer that through the government to provide goods and services. To some extent, that's what the military-industrial complex does. It takes our wealth, transfers it through taxes to the government. Well, the government transfers it then to this very, very narrow, wasteful, pretty much unproductive sector of the economy, the military production economy. So we'll see. I don't know. Maybe others know more about that. They historically, you are absolutely right, Jeff. The doctors' organization has opposed, but we'll see. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Tim in Lincoln Park. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Pete and Jolene.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like to kind of put a shout-out to Doctors Without Borders. They do very good work you know, overseas, and they go to a lot of war-torn areas, and I don't think they're doing it for the money.
Certainly not.
There are a lot of good people in there. But also, I want to address the caller's concerns for poor Exxon that's really struggling with the biggest of profits in history, $45 billion last year.
Yep.
And
quarter.
Last quarter, right.
Yeah.
And what he failed to recognize was in 2001 and 2002, Cheney put together a quote-unquote energy task force, and he brought in leading members from Exxon, BP, Chevron, and all the others, and they basically carved out Iraq for him. You had all sorts of maps for northern, central, and southern Iraq, and all these had little oil flags on them, and the fix was in. You know, you go into Iraq, grab their oil. And Cheney and all these oil executives were into the whole thing. And Condoleezza Rice, who was the Secretary of State, was part of Chevron, and she was in on those talks. So a lot of people made a lot of money off oil, and that's what this whole thing is about.
Well, when they, and we should be clear, when they say they made a lot of money, we ought to also be very clear about the origins of the wealth. Again, this transfer. When we work, we have a certain amount of income that is disposable in a number of ways, and when gas prices go up, we're financing the wealth that they made, that they accumulated, that they made. They didn't really make it. They took it. Because we had no other, we had no other option. Because that's the two aspects of big capital. One is looting, and the other is blackmail.
We're also, Peter and Jolene, financing a lot of the shipping lanes that are open. A lot of this doesn't even go into the refineries or the research they do. A lot of the research they don't even do at all. We're just keeping it open to the shipping lanes, and a lot of this goes back into the military sector. It goes into the shipbuilding sector. And we're talking about very, very big ships with large amounts of oil. And they have no interest in refining any type of oil for the mass consumption. I mean, it's all about gouging and profit-taking.
What is, though, I don't know whether you would, Tim, have any more insight into the mind of these conservatives that are obviously middle-class or working-class people that defend this looting of the middle class and the working class. I mean, what?
You know, I talked to my friends about that, and a lot of my friends claim that it has to do with the media in this country, that it promotes so many conservative ideas, including in the mainstream media, and therefore people really don't have any idea of how the economy works, and they have this delusion that if they work hard enough, they'll get rich. So they think, therefore, that any tax cuts for the rich will benefit them, and they have no understanding of basically capitalism is an exploitative system.
I don't know. I don't know why people can't think in terms of their own best interests, the interests of their family, the interests of our community. And it certainly isn't seeing that Exxon gets the maximum profit. It's the other way around, I'd say. Tim, thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate your call.
I continue to buy my gas at Citgo.
Citgo, yeah.
I continue.
Not Citgo. Citgo.
Citgo.
Citgo.
Citgo.
And why do you do that, Jolene?
Well, usually it's cheaper, but the real reason is because it's not going to these fat cats. It's actually, it's 40% of the profits, or wait, we get 40% of our oil from Venezuela. This is Venezuelan oil.
Right.
Right. And some of the money goes to the poor of that country.
Well, their wealth.
And Chavez is the one who gives it to them.
Yeah, and including some people, something like a couple hundred thousand people. In the United States are subsidized.
And in other places in the United States are subsidized by Citgo. Yeah.
So even when I was paying $4.25 a gallon, which killed me, it was not going to ExxonMobil.
Yeah, I can't in my heart do that. I will drive around as far as I can to find a Citgo.
I wonder if that's clear to people. Here's what's going on. If you buy from ExxonMobil, no matter what the price is, it winds up going to stockholders. People say, yeah, but it goes to Chavez, who hates America. I actually hated George Bush. And, I think of a lot of criticisms of Chavez, mostly from the left of him, but that's another story. But, that the profits that were made by the Venezuelan oil company, including those that are made from Citgo, as Jolene just said, go into the poor of Venezuela, go into the poor of the United States and other countries around the Caribbean. So, hats off to Citgo.
Yeah, bring it. I'm all about it.
Yeah, and you go. I think it's just citgo.com. You can see all these programs.
Oh, yeah, if you really want to know what we're talking. We're not just blowing smoke.
All right.
This is documented evidence.
Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. We're at 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G.
Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, we're going to get you in a room.
Log on and listen worldwide at WRIF.com.
The Riff.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing, and we want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood and Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's D-E-M-M-E-R.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
Don't let the economic blues keep you from enjoying a safe and enjoyable night out. Loftus Limousine and Luxury Coach offers reasonable rates for all. From luxury sedans to party coaches, Loftus Limousine and Luxury Coach has over 50 vehicles to choose from. That's why they're the cars to the stars. Find out why at 1-800-A-LIMO-4U or LAVDAS.com.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIN.
All right, welcome back. 313-298-WRIF. You know, I don't think we had our official ID. Do you know what? Can you rattle it off the top of your head?
Yeah, we'll see. 101-WRIF and one and WRIF-HD1 Detroit.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Yeah, I'm going to do something.
I've done that for a while.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to do something that... I don't know. Usually I don't like it. I want to read this article. Don't go away. This is about drugs.
Wait, they're coming back.
Yeah,
I feel
this is
them.
About drugs. Tougher border can't stop Mexican marijuana cartels. You know, this is the gangs. This is from Tucson, New York Times, February 2nd. Drug smugglers parked a car transport trailer. You know those big things?
Yeah, you see the cars. Yeah. We see a lot of those around here.
Yeah, they parked it against the Mexican side of the border one day in December, dropped a ramp over the security fence, and drove two pickup trucks filled with marijuana onto Arizona soil. As Border Patrol agents gave chase, a third truck appeared on the Mexican side, and gunmen sprayed machine gun fire over the fence at the agents.
Wow.
Smugglers in the first vehicle torched one truck, abandoned the other, with $1 million worth of marijuana still in the truck bed. Then they vaulted back over the barrier into Mexico's Sonora State. Despite huge government enforcement actions on both sides of the southwest border, the Mexican marijuana trade is more robust and brazen than ever, law enforcement officials say. Mexican drug cartels routinely transported industrial-sized loads of marijuana in 2008, excavating new tunnels and adopting tactics like ramp-assisted smuggling to get their cargoes across undetected.
Well, there's a little bit of a market for the ganja
in the
U.S.
But these are not the only new tactics. The cartels are also increasingly planting marijuana crops inside the U.S. in a major strategy shift to avoid the border altogether. Last year, drug enforcement authorities confiscated record amounts of high-potency plants from Miami to San Diego and even from vineyards leased by cartels in Washington State.
Really?
Yeah, this is amazing. Mexican drug traffickers also have moved into hydroponic marijuana production, you know, the stuff grown in doors in water with sun lamps. Pardon me. Challenging Asian networks and smaller individual growers. A Justice Department report issued last year concluded that Mexican drug trafficking organizations now operated in 195 cities, up from 50 cities in 2006.
Now, I'm not sure what to think about that whole thing, Peter.
Yeah.
Are the officials getting more paranoid?
No, I think this is, in other words, this enforcement, this drug war is a total defeat.
Right, yeah.
There's evidence that the Mexican cartels are also increasing their relationship with prison and street gangs in the United States in order to facilitate drug trafficking. For the cartels, marijuana is the king crop. Special Agent Rafael Reyes, chief of the Mexico and Central American section of the DEA, said, it consistently sustains its marketability and profitability. Marijuana trafficking continues virtually unabated in the United States, even as intelligence reports suggest the declining availability of heroin, cocaine, and other hard drugs that require extensive smuggling operations. Why wouldn't, seems like easier than marijuana, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. By combining smuggling with domestic production, the cartels have sustained the marijuana trade despite the onslaught of enforcement actions on both sides of the border. From 2000 through 2007, Mexican authorities arrested more than 90,000 drug traffickers, more than 400 hitmen, and a dozen cartel leaders, and the United States extradited 95 Mexican nationals. There, read from here. My voice is...
Where are you?
But the price has been high. Like that. I'm going to cough.
But the price has been high. Tensions have increased among the cartels, which are warring over lucrative drug routes through Mexican border towns. Oh, yeah, like Juarez, Tijuana, Nogales, Sonora, and Tijuana. Oh, it's a mess.
Yeah, you don't want to go there.
No one, you know, young college boys would go over there and watch the donkey shows and drink tequila. I know, but no more donkey show. Find your own here in the U.S. More than 6,000 people, including hundreds of police officers, were killed by drug-related violence.
You get this? Hundreds of police in Mexico have been killed by these guys. This is over the top. Border Patrol agents are also reporting more violent confrontations with traffickers. As the Mexican government and American authorities have hardened the border, drug cartels are increasing production just north of it to avoid resorting to smuggling. Many of the largest marijuana plantations are hidden on federal and state parkland, a bunch of other stuff. And then at the end, it says drug enforcement agents uprooted about 6.6 million cannabis plants grown mostly by cartels in 2007, one-third more than plants destroyed in 2006. In California, the nation's largest domestic marijuana producer, the authorities eradicated a record 3 million plants by the end of the marijuana harvest in December. Huh. Now, okay, so what does enforcement do? What does suppression do? It keeps the price high enough to maintain this industry as a profitable one to have people do this. I mean, just think if they would have had another 10 million plants producing. It probably wouldn't have been worth all this effort. In other words, the efforts of the so-called drug war, whenever you hear war, you know, like war on this, war on that, be very suspicious. But here's what I'm telling you, that all the suppression effort, the billions and billions and billions of dollars that you and I spend to keep people from smoking flowers and changing their consciousness, because you know why that's bad, because
people enjoy it. Drug,
people are, well, it says heroin's going down, cocaine's going down, usage. So,
I just read an article in the local paper here that heroin use is up.
Yeah, I did say that in the Free Press here locally. But there's not very many heroin and or cocaine users in the United States. But in any event, it ain't nobody's business if I do, as the old song from the 20s goes.
True.
You don't want people driving. You don't want people in gate. You don't want people at your workplace intoxicated on anything.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about things like domestic violence and, you know.
Well, man.
Things
I'm
like
too.
That.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Why? This just does not...
Well, then we should get rid of... If we're worried about domestic violence, we should prohibit alcohol. The largest generator of family abuse, spousal and child abuse. The point being that not only are these efforts a total waste of time, they actually ensure the profitability of the drug trade, and hence it's continuous. So it's a Mobius strip. You know what that is? That thing that just kind of feeds back on itself, that goes round and round. It's actually a three-dimensional object that's one-sided.
Whoa.
You know that? You know what a Mobius strip is?
Man, no.
I'll make one for you in a second.
Great.
Yeah, like that.
Fun at the commercial break.
Well, you take a strip of paper about an inch long. Well, here, I can't use my hands.
You can't.
An inch long, and you make one twist in it and tape it together.
Oh, sure. And kind of like a figure eight.
And if you put your finger on it, it only has one side.
Oh.
And if you put your finger on the edge, it only has one edge.
Wow, Peter.
Wow, man.
Man.
You know,
so
if you do like
psychedelic.
If you do a Michael Phelps and
then, do a big bonger.
And then get your Mobius strip out.
Leave Michael Phelps alone.
Yeah, hands off Michael Phelps. You know the lung capacity that guy must have?
You know what? And what? Bill Maher said it. I won't even steal it from him. He said, this is proof that you can be a pothead and still perform.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bill Maher making sense once again.
Well, I haven't said this in a long time, but I used to say, I have known so many stoners that were judges, prosecutors, lawyers, cops, doctors.
Oh,
man, doctors.
Yeah.
That scares me.
Yeah.
But
I know a lot of soccer moms.
A lot of, yeah, I mean, come on. So it doesn't have much to do with performance. But there's, like, everything. Intoxicants, there's a time and a place for everything.
Yeah.
And when you're doing something where other people's safety or interests are involved, you should be good and sober. Although,
sure.
I've had people, you know, lawyers say, man, I can't write a brief unless I'm high.
Well, yeah, maybe they're very hyper or they
well,
need
it
to
is.
Calm down.
Well, it does have
a
self-medicating aspect to it.
Sure does.
All right, so end the war on drugs, which is essentially the war on our neighbors.
True.
Yeah, I don't mean our neighbors to the south. I mean our neighbors in our community.
Our neighbors, yeah.
Yeah. Here's Jason in Detroit. Jason, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Well, I have a question about health care, but I think you got a shot maybe these next few years, depending on how things go, with including maybe legalization of marijuana and the stimulus plan.
Well, it would cut crime so amazingly.
And it would bring money in, and we don't have to train anybody to grow it, I don't think, so.
Right.
You know, I just...
You put the
seeds in. I think there's a real shot at it now the next couple of years, depending on how things go, but we'll see. But I wanted to ask your opinion upon something because I have a lot of friends that are conservative. I'm kind of in the middle, but on the healthcare issue, I kind of side with them. I don't think the national government can really handle it, but I think maybe more on a state and local level. It might work out a lot better, and I don't know why I don't hear more ideas to try to have the states run it. I think even if we go back and we look at the original Constitution, that is something that is a state power. It's not really something for Washington, D.C. And, you know, one of the other things I think about is, you know, if I have a problem, you know, with a policy or a health problem, you know, if it's done on a state or local level or a county level, I can get in my car and go see the insurance people or the doctors instead of it me calling another state or, you know.
I hear you. Well, you know, there's nothing I would necessarily argue with you about. I mean, if it worked better that way, let's go for it. You know, do you use a computer?
Yeah.
Okay. Try this website. I haven't even gone to it, but it's hr676.org. hr676.org, and they make the argument for a national health insurance system. And you're right, in like Massachusetts has something close to universal health care on a state level, and who knows? The only problem we don't want to get into is that it's real good in Massachusetts and real bad in Alabama. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know, I hope maybe some states take the lead and other states follow. You know, but it's actually from what I've seen is there has been efforts, you know, going back to the Nixon years to try to do national health care, but it always seems to backfire. You know, it just ends up certain people get rich and other people get.
Well, there is something called Medicare, and that's worked out just swell for most people. I mean, is it a government program? Yes. Does it mean there's going to be a bureaucracy? Yes. Does it mean sometimes it's going to leave you tearing your hair out? Yes. But, I mean, no one would suggest leaving our seniors without any guaranteed national health insurance. And I don't know. But,
I think Vermont's made some steps, too. I wonder, you know, why don't we hear more about states doing that? Are just afraid to touch it, or do you?
Yeah, I think maybe I should go take a look. I'll do that. Thank you, Jason. Good suggestion. And if it would make it less bureaucratic and better to or easier, less costly to administer, sure. Let's do it that way. But let's get people what they need. That's our problem. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. It is Daryl in Livonia. Hi, Daryl. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I talked to you a few weeks ago. I mean, a lot of times you're a good help. There's about three things I want to talk about. I'll hit them, each one of them kind of briefly. I lost my job in 2003, and these bill collectors have guaranteed my wages. I try to explain it to them that I'm only making part-time wages now because I can't find a full-time job anywhere where I can get back on my feet, and it's like they're just kicking you down.
Right.
Okay, and...
You mean they got a guarantee order on you?
Yeah, already. They will not work with me at all. I tried working with them, and I offered to make a payment. They refused the payment I offered them, and they're taking about $56 a week out of my check, and that hurts. Working only part-time, working about 25 hours a week.
Boy.
And when this gas prices hit, it hit me especially hard because I wasn't making a lot of money. And this national health care, like what that one caller was talking about, state to state,
yeah.
Tennessee has their own health care, and they take, if you don't make a lot of money, they take a few dollars a week out of your check where everybody pays for it.
Yeah, it's called TennCare, but that's, I think, been kind of eroded because of, partly because of finances. You know, the states are broke.
Tennessee's got it. My brother went down there to be with his kids and stuff, and national health care would be great for everybody, you know. And
yeah, Daryl, I take it right now you don't have any health care, right?
No, I don't. Well, I do, but it's not the way I want it.
Yeah.
I don't have no health care at all. My wife is type 2 diabetic. She's going blind.
Oh, boy.
Last year I had a mild heart attack because of all the stress and worry that was all put on me. And these doctors, these hospitals, I ran a hospital bill up to $34,000, and they're coming after me.
This is criminal. This is,
yeah.
No one deserves that kind of treatment. You know, I think I was even using this phrase last week. They said, you know, these conservatives will say, the world doesn't owe you a living. You know, the world, our society, our community owes all of us a life that's not filled with anxiety and filled with stress and filled with unrewarding work of, you know,
Peter, and then on top of it, we turn to Social Security for Social Security disability for my wife. They said, no, you've got, she's legally blind in one eye right now.
Boy.
And she's got retina that's going to be separating. I got to take her in this week to have the cataract removed, and then she's got to go in 2 weeks later and have the retina reattached to her left eye. They said, you got one good eye, you're able to work.
Oh, man. Hey, if I can ask you, how old are you guys?
Okay, my wife, she's 10 years old. My wife's 56, and I'm 46.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and I'm getting nailed left and right, and I'm at my wit's end.
I don't blame you. And nobody should be at their, you know who should be at their wit's end? The people that caused all this, the people that benefit from the system that has done so much harm to people like the two of you. And, you know, Daryl, I mean, I don't think this will make you feel any better about it, but there are millions of people
exactly
like you and your wife.
It's the same boat I'm in, but yet these people that are rich and getting richer off the fuel. And one thing I like was, I hated to see it, was the stock market go down. I hated it, but the same token, it hit the rich people right in their wallets.
Well, it did. On the other hand, though, it also hit all the working people that had these retirement funds and 401ks and people that were living off stocks that they had bought over their working lives and all. But the people at the top are the ones that are hurt the least. I mean, obviously, if you have a net worth of $17 million and you lose half of it, I should have picked a different figure. I can't even do the math. But you're not bad. If you have $100,000 and suddenly it's like at $50,000, well, that's significant. So, I mean, really, who has been hurt badly in this are the people who aren't responsible for what's happened. And that's something dramatically wrong with this situation. And I think all of us have the right to reward ourselves for our good work and hard work, or if we have difficulties, medical or whatever, that we're not just thrown to the wolves. I mean, nobody deserves that. All right, best of luck to you, Daryl. I'm sorry to hear about all that. It makes me so angry.
I know.
And almost, I've said this before, haven't I, that I almost, and I stress almost, I mean, I almost feel ashamed that of the privilege I have, that I have a job, that I have
healthcare.
That I have a home that I don't have to worry about and all that.
Yeah.
And,
well, you should feel fortunate.
Well, I do feel fortunate, and I guess it's, you know, it's almost, I guess, embarrassing in a way. That, you know, and the conservative thing, well, you worked for it, and, you know, they should have, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, these heartless people without a bit of compassion
I know.
In their hearts.
Yeah, well, I just choose not to, associate with people like that.
You know, remember the film Blade Runner?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, I watched it recently.
Did you?
Did I?
Did you read, watch the director's cut? There's all these different...
I know there are, but I haven't watched that one yet.
Yeah. Well, it comes from...
I had never seen it before.
Yeah. It comes from a book. There's a wonderful science fiction writer who's... what the hell's his name? His last name. I remember. I got to get his first name together with his... who's written a number of books. His last name's Dick.
Oh, yeah. You know, I have a science fiction geek for a neighbor. He could tell you right now.
Yeah, why can't I remember what his name was? Okay, all the emails are
I'll be able to tell you.
Anyway, yeah. And his book was called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? That was the book that Blade Runner came from.
Right.
What's his name?
His computer's slow.
Oh, okay. And go ahead.
I don't have it yet.
Okay, and remember that they were looking for these replicants, these androids that had escaped human control.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what the whole thing was about.
Right. Yes.
And they would look in there.
Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick. Right. And they would be able to use these kind of interrogation questions and device to find out.
Yes.
And it didn't make it totally clear in the movie, but in the book it does, is that to be human, you had to have the capacity to empathize. You had to feel what other people felt, even if you weren't in that situation. And the message in that book and in that movie was, if you couldn't empathize, you weren't human. That's what it was really all
well,
about.
Well, that should be the motto right here, right now, then.
And Philip K. Dick had a number of his books made into movies, including Total Recall with Arnold. Arnold never...
I liked that one.
Yeah.
And I'm not an Arnold fan at all.
And that was, let me see, I Can Dream It For You Wholesale. That was the book. And then there was one that was half animation and half human that was just recently came out. I didn't see that one.
Anyway. Oh, okay. I think I know which one you're talking about, too.
Are we in the air? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hi. 313-298-WRIF. Well, I want to get to this call in a little while, but he just got on. You know, he's just been waiting. Let's talk about Bush. God, I haven't heard that name.
Who?
Oh, man, yeah.
We won't forget.
Yeah. Here's Tony and Willis. Tony, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Peter, Jolene, hello.
Hi.
Well, I'm still at my wit's end over the ExxonMobil thing.
Yeah.
I mean, not only, you know, the fact that they're stealing from the American people, but also for what they did in Alaska.
Sure.
With the Exxon Valdez.
I was just thinking that earlier. I'm thinking, you know, and all the damage they caused with that.
You will not forget. They shouldn't. You shouldn't. Shouldn't forget.
Don't forget.
They ruined people's livelihoods, and they spent, I don't know how much money and how, I forget how long it's been, but I don't think they've paid any money for the damage they caused.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
they had billions of dollars of damages, and they've kept appealing and appealing and appealing.
Oh.
Exactly. And I tell anyone and everyone that I can find about this, and it just like goes in one ear, out the other. I tell people, do not buy gas from them, and they still do it. I mean, it's... Oh,
yeah, I think people
it's
just
madness,
go...
And I don't know how you possibly can stop it.
I think people just, you know, look at their gauge and they go, okay, that's 194, I'll go there. Yeah.
No, man, I if I'm out of gas, I'm walking to another gas station. I will not buy gas from them. I mean, no one should. I mean, if we could all band together, seriously, I mean, we could one way or another, if not put them out of business, seriously hurt them.
Well, unfortunately, Tony, and having ideas that manifest themselves on a grander scale with masses of people are good, but boycotts, consumer boycotts, have rarely been very effective. But
I like the idea of them, though.
I do. I mean, like I do. I agree with you. I boycott ExxonMobil.
Remember, it was the Don't Buy Any Gas Day within the last couple of years or whatever it was, and the one guy called and said he was going to fill up everything that he had. He was going against it.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
going to fill up his lawnmower and his snowblower and, you know, everything.
What are with those people?
I know.
All right, Tony, thank you for calling from Willis, Michigan.
Really? I don't know where that is.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Roger, who is our phone screener, who we thank very much. And even if you don't like what I'm saying or Jolene is saying...
Don't get in his face about it.
You don't know what Roger thinks.
He's just doing his job. Well, he's with us. Shh.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. He tells us that the movie I was trying to think of was A Scanner Darkly. Is that the name of it? A Scanner, but I know that it had Scanner Darkly.
Okay, well, I didn't know that one.
Or A Scanner Darkly? No, but A Scanner Darkly with Keanu Reeves was the movie.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. 313-298-WRIF. You know, one of the things that I just don't understand what's going on with the Obama administration, given that he knows how the Iraq War has sunk the American economy. It's going to wind up costing us, we're talking about $875 billion. Well, the Iraq War, they keep putting it up all the time. It's going to cost us $2.2 trillion. It could cost $3 trillion. And if we had all that money, if that hadn't gone down this rat hole based on Bush lies and the destruction of Iraq, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, including thousands and thousands of Americans. You know, I had this little slip here that, oh, yeah, here it is. You know, I just saw some neocon talking about how that Iraq was a victory, that all the liberals that criticized it were wrong.
Yeah, and he's on that planet. What is that called?
You know, he's
Uranus.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. No, I thought you were going to say he's on a river called Denial.
Yeah, he's on that, too.
Yeah.
On that planet.
The total U.S. dead so far of Americans dead in Iraq and Afghanistan is 4,879. The wounded in Iraq is 44,993.
Wow.
You understand what this means, people? 640 so far Americans have died in Afghanistan, although the coalition have already lost 1,000 men and probably some women as well. The wounded in Afghanistan, 2,686. I probably should have made some totals here, but we're talking, you remember the dead in Vietnam was 58,000, and who knows how many hundreds of thousands of wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're up around 50,000 at least in terms of dead and wounded.
So the comparisons to Vietnam just continue and to continue to be true.
Yeah.
Fact.
167 men have committed suicide in Iraq.
Oh, yeah, and that's increased. Three-decade high army suicides. I feel like I'm... This is terrible, and I feel like I'm becoming immune to it. And I swore I would not do that. And so I think it's important that we continue to talk about that, Peter.
Sure.
Real important.
Well, there's this this meeting over in Munich, and Obama's national security team gave this dire assessment of the war in Afghanistan the new... State Department Special Envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, he said it's going to be a long, difficult struggle. In my view, it's going to be much tougher than Iraq.
And NATO's future goes back and forth.
NATO's future is on the line here. Let's parse that. Let's look at that for some precision. NATO's future is on the line here. So those kind of things just kind of wash by us. Remember what NATO stands for? North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's not exactly near the North Atlantic, is it? It's in Central Asia. There is no reason, absolutely no reason to be fighting a war in Afghanistan.
You know, Peter, I was thinking about this when I was reading this article in the Times about Afghanistan today. And I remember when 9/11 happened and... The hunt was on for Osama bin Laden. And do you remember?
Sure, I do.
I was like, let's go in there. And you looked at me in horror. Like, no, Julian, I did not get it, but I really get it. And
well, what I meant by if there were criminals, international criminals that had committed this heinous mass murder, they ought to be apprehended by whatever means possible. That the Taliban government had no capacity or probably no will to apprehend these people that were hidden up in these mountains.
No, Will.
Yeah, it's not like, well, it's not like they had an office in downtown Kabul.
Right.
Right? Yeah. There's not even ever been clear that the connection between the Taliban government and Al-Qaeda. But, in fact, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, there's an essay or an article called Wake Up Obama, Afghanistan is No Threat to America, and it represents absolutely no threat whatsoever. We should be dealing with people that that have criminal intent to do harm to anybody anywhere, and particularly in this country. There ought to be ways at which we begin to erode the basis for the kind of hatred and resentment that so many people around the world have. And that if people took a new tact, I think that could be done. In the meantime, of course, we have to have vigilance and whatever. But I just saw this interview with the Soviet commander that was part of the 500,000 Soviet troops that were in Afghanistan.
Whoa.
In the 1980s.
Yeah.
And into the 1990s, and lost, or I guess into the 1980s only, and lost. The Soviets lost with 500,000 troops. The Taliban now controls 70% of Afghanistan.
Wow. And didn't we go in there to wipe them out?
Yeah.
Oh, see how that didn't work? That's what you were saying.
General David Petraeus, head of the U.S. Central Command, said war in Afghanistan, quote, has deteriorated markedly in the last 2 years and warned of a, quote, downward spiral of security. He, in addition to more troops, he called for a surge in civilian capacity, would help rebuild villages. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's just this intense corruption that so much of the billions that have been spent there have never made it to the local level. Afghanistan, is so corrupt, it makes Iraq look like a model of probity. Is that the word? I don't know. I might have made that one up. No, I think it's a word. But Petraeus said Afghanistan has been known over the years as the graveyard of empires. We cannot take that history lightly. This is General Petraeus saying Afghanistan has been known over the years as a graveyard of empires. We cannot take that history lightly. We'll be the empire, though, that will force our will on the Afghan people, right? Britain couldn't do it. The Soviets couldn't do it. People back in the Middle Ages and before couldn't do it. By the way, there's an incredible little video that's front and center on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Or you can go to RethinkAfghanistan.com, RethinkAfghanistan.com. Also, Kyrgyzstan is going to close the U.S. base used to supply Afghanistan. I mean, we've got bases in Central Asia. That's where our fortune is going. That's why we don't have the capacity to help ourselves, because we're fighting this needless, endless war, too. I mean, Barack Obama inherited this war, but very soon it's going to be Barack Obama's war. I have on my website Bush's Slaughtergate, and this is a listing of all the U.S. casualties and the Iraqi casualties. And pretty soon, I'm going to have on my website, Obama's Slaughtergate, and have the listing of the deaths in Afghanistan.
It is fair game.
Yeah. All right. Peter and Jillian, we'll be right back with our final segment. If you're on hold, please stay there. We will be right back. And we are at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Whoever controls technology controls the world.
Listening to The Riff has never been easier. On your Apple iPhone 3G, hit the iTunes Store. Download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world. Details at WRIF.com. From 101 Road.
You know the drill. Just a pill to get through the flight, or maybe a glass of wine, maybe an antidepressant to help control your anxiety and depression, maybe a nerve pill here and there just to help you cope, maybe a drink at night just to take the edge off, and that second drink, well, who's counting? But nobody knows how much you worry, how stressed out you are, how inadequate you feel. Nobody understands the fear you have, the lack of satisfaction in your life, the loneliness. Well, I understand. I'm Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center. I suffered for over 20 years with anxiety, depression, panic, and stress. Maybe you don't have to depend on medication and alcohol. There's a better, long-lasting, healthy way to help yourself. Please, call right now and let me send you a powerful free tape that could change your life.
Call now and we'll send you this wonderful free tape. Call 800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Jalene Jordan is with me. And let's see, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, we're going to have a couple of interesting interviews, and if I can't find the list of it in this huge mess, wait a minute, I think I actually have this up here on there it is, yeah. It's Peter Werby, WERBE.com. You can always go to that website, at least by Friday, sometimes by Thursday, and see what guests are going to that we're going to have. And you can there's a link right at the top, on-air guests, and you can see the ones from the past, and it also links to their books and what have you. Anyways, the first guest is going to be Alan Michael Collins. And he's written The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History, and How We Can Fight Back. He describes how educational loans can cripple individuals and how the 5 million default loans may be the next bubble to burst. So I know a lot of you are, particularly if you're thinking about college, another thing besides fighting the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, maybe we should have made higher education free as well, just like the rest of public education. Larry Gabriel, also, who a former editor of the Metro Times, who was my editor there, and also of the UAW Solidarity magazine when I worked for the UAW. Jalene and I co-hosted a show on a network owned by the UAW. He's got a real sweet little book out, a memoir called Daddy Plays Old Time New Orleans. I've left out the word jazz. Oh, my God.
You can always proofread while you're on the air.
Yeah. Daddy Plays Old-Time New Orleans Jazz, Six Generations in the Music Business, and the story of his musical family based in Detroit and New Orleans. So it's a pretty sweet story. Larry's a nice guy.
Wonderful. Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. So that's at 1 a.m. A lot of people.
Yeah, full lines. Zip through these.
So let's see. Here's Glenn in Melvindale. Hey, Glenn, you're on the air. Hi.
How you doing there, buddy?
Good. Can you turn off your radio?
Yeah, hang on one second here. I'm turning it off right now.
Okay.
I'm turning it off. All right. Yeah, I was calling about the situation they were talking about a minute ago.
What's that?
About, they were talking about people using heroin use or marijuana as a gateway drug.
Yeah.
I was joking.
Joking.
You know what? Well, I'm joking. Is that what you said?
No, she said she's joking. It's not a gateway drug.
Yeah, I was pretending to be like my mother.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like tens of millions of people have smoked
and just smoke.
2% of them, you know, go on to heroin or cocaine or something.
I mean, yeah, how can you use marijuana as a gateway drug to anything? I mean, come on. If you test the people in your building where you work at, I guarantee you 60% will test positive for marijuana.
Well, we're in radio, first of all.
If you don't test positive, they fire you.
Well,
if you pass a drug test here, you're out.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you pass it, you're out, right? who am I talking to? Who's this lady?
I'm Jalene.
Julie. Hi, damn. How you doing, girl?
Good, man.
I heard you 100 times, or many times. You went my favorite radio station.
Well, right. Rock on.
Riff on. Rock on, that's right. Yeah, but anyway, I'm going to get back to my point. I was talking about that a minute ago. I think that's just straight ridiculous, you know? And whoever came out with that argument about that was just fire.
Yeah, it was just a bunch of hooey. You know, that's just part of that whole, you know, those drug ads.
Yeah,
on television.
They've
gone way too far now, but that was all, you know, part of the.
That's another
the
billion dollars that's spent and.
Wasted, in my opinion, right. Our opinion.
And they've done these studies that show it just makes. They actually make people want to do drugs. Really?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I watched that, Leaving Las Vegas, where Nicolas Cage was drinking himself to death, I wanted to go to the bar! So there you go.
Whatever. All right. Thank you, Glenn. Here's Troy in Southfield. Troy, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air with us on WRIF.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good.
My question is, do you feel that Bush and Cheney administration relationship with the kings and the princesses of those Arabic nations and also with the big oil companies should be investigated? Was it a plot to start the war for oil? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think two things. One, there ought to be criminal indictments for a large number of people within the Bush administration for violations of U.S. statutes, the U.S. Constitution, international law, and within the administration itself. Alberto Gonzalez for perjury in front of Congress. I mean, you could go on and on and on. And, Barack Obama says, you know, that's the past. We want to go on to the future. But the if you let crimes go unpunished, what's the message there? Because it sooner or later, if things keep going along as they've gone along throughout our history, the Republicans will be back and they'll think, well, wait a minute. We broke all these laws. We did what we want. We lied. We cheated. We broke, the trust of the American people. And what happened to us? Absolutely nothing.
Yeah. So, did you hear that Roberto Gonzalez interview on NPR, which was so, it was so, such
that's,
a,
that's his cousin. It's Alberto.
Alberto, I mean.
Yeah, right.
God, you can tell I'm fading fast. It's late. That's the second thing I've gotten wrong in about 15 minutes, but please forgive me.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, he was on there just, he did nothing wrong. No, I did nothing wrong. You know, just really, these guys are so repellent.
Yeah, off frog march them out of their ritzy homes into a waiting police van. Good point, though, Troy. Thank you very much. Appreciate
in shackles.
In shackles, yeah. Here's Susie in Hazel Park. Hi, Susie.
Oh, hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
I'm good. You're on the air.
Jolene.
Hi. Hi, Susie.
I'm Rich's mom. We met Peter, Rich with the dreadlock.
Oh, yeah.
Hi. Say hi to Rich for us.
I certainly will. You know, I listen every week all the time.
Oh, good.
I was in one evening, and I was disappointed not to get to meet you, Jolene.
I know. It was one of those times when I was just not here.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
From last week.
Yeah.
Gosh, I was going to say stuff. Huh? Starstruck here, sorry.
Okay, do you want to talk about Afghanistan, drugs? There's so many things.
Well, Susie, when you can't remember what you called in to talk about, we think you want to talk about
short-term
drugs.
Short-term memory cells are hit. They're gone. And, you know, the offspring, you know, like you said, I cracked up laughing when you guys were saying, if you pass a drug test, you're out of here.
Ouch!
That was very interesting. But, yes, as a matter of fact, Rich happened to be sitting here when we were very into the, you know, watching the election, and I'm not one to have been in the past very much. And I did jump on the bandwagon, and I was really, really, really moved about things. But the medicinal marijuana law passed while Rich happened to be sitting here with me, which is an odd feeling. Like I said, it seems like he was born yesterday, but, you know, we have the same views, and I just taught him as far as, you know, it was definitely hidden from him until he was about 15 and wasn't foolish anymore and figured it out, but still not brought around him. And wasn't until he was an adult that, you know, I decided, if nothing else, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do, the kids. And so what I did is I was aware of everything all the time. We discussed it prior to him usually doing anything that he has done, and I figured at least with a little guidance, you know, guiding him instead of letting him go with things blind as a teenager was the better situation. And, you know, ultimately, he's a pretty well-rounded guy. And,
he is.
You know, we all make our mistakes, but he is just he's doing fantastic, and I think it might have worked.
Well, great. It sounds like you're
That's a good approach.
Job, huh?
That's a good approach.
Absolutely.
You know, it really is.
It seems to have been working thus far, yes, even with the 17-year-old girl, which is, I mean, it's not often that a mom and a daughter don't ever have that thing where you can't stand your mom, whatever, blah, blah, blah. She's now 17, and we've never, ever gotten to that place.
Well, that is so terrific. Susie,
will you? Fantastic. Thing.
Yeah.
Say hello to Rich for us, okay?
I will say hello to Rich. I let him know that some new stuff's been playing as of late, and that was nice to hear. They're finally playing the one with Julian's name in it.
Yeah.
Correct,
yeah. All right. Well, we've got to move on, so thank you. Glad to have you on the air, and our best to Rich. All right. By the way, since there was medical marijuana passed as legalizing it, this article that I just saw from, what is it, cngnews.com, I don't know if you can still find it, because it was from January. The state's first medical marijuana clinic is defending its legality as residents, government officials, and law enforcement agencies learn more about the controversial proposal voters approved in November. And let's see, there's let me get these them on the air. But you can you can look up THC Foundation, THC Foundation.
Okay.
And it's THC-foundation.com/Michigan. Well, I guess it's probably a national group, but yeah. So it's THC-foundation.com/Michigan. So, we got to go get our card, Julie.
I have a little bit of a blood pressure issue.
Okay, there you go. But
it's
what stops you?
With me.
What stops you then? We joke about this. Julian and I never do anything that is illegal. But say you qualified for medical marijuana, right?
I do.
Say you did.
Let's say I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you get a card.
When did we have this conversation?
You go get a pound. I don't think you get that much. But anyway, so we're sitting around, and you say, well, I got to do my medicine here.
And got to take my meds.
And I start singing, don't bogart that joint, my friend. Pass it over. So
I'm sure that never happened.
And so you could give it to me who doesn't qualify for it, right?
Right.
But maybe that would mean you are acting improperly.
Oh, you could get in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would take your card away.
I would never do that.
They would take your card away.
I would never do that.
Okay, good. All right. let's see. Do we have about 10 more minutes, 3 more calls, and some open lines? So you could do it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Kevin in Kenton. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Julian, how are you guys doing? Happy New Year. I know we're into February, but...
What the hell?
Still Happy New Year.
I wanted to talk about 9/11 and, Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you were talking about how those auto workers, fought for... this is tying in, hear me out. But they sat around and they fought for, what they had got, and they won.
Right.
And I think, enough is enough with this Iraq war. First of all, the terrorists, this was, 9/11 was their plot to just, cost us millions and billions and trillions of dollars, and they got us where they want us, and enough is enough. It's time to get out. Can the military people just drop their equipment and say, I want to go home, I'm leaving today, get me on a plane, I quit the Army, I'm done.
I don't think that's going to happen. That's called mass mutiny. I'll tell you, somebody who I've interviewed before, Paul Rykoff, who's the executive director for Iraq and Afghan Veterans of America, he said in January, you were wishing me a Happy New Year, and January was just a few days ago, in January, says Rykoff, we lost more soldiers to suicide than to Al-Qaeda.
I believe that.
That's amazing.
Hope we don't lose any more that way.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, but you're right. Out now ought to be the slogan, although you can't just go home. I mean, what one has to do when you're... They have to take every military vehicle and clean it, and then they, shrink wrap it. put it on these big... I mean, really? And there is so much over there. There's billions and hundreds of billions of dollars. Well, I don't know, tens of billions of dollars at a minimum.
I mean, I've moved a lot, equipment. But this is...
This is, yeah, you have moved a lot. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Theo's in Detroit. Hi, Theo. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Happy Sunday to both of you.
Well, thank you, Theo.
You too.
I was calling regarding a talk show host, but first I wanted to comment on two things you had. Do you think that with the legalization of marijuana that it might cut a little bit into the profit of drug dealers? Is that why folks are upset?
Well, yeah, remember I was saying earlier that if you, I got you, sorry. But let me just bring people back to that. They've confiscated, what was it, like 10 million plants through eradicating 10 million plants. And if those 10 million plants were still there, in other words, if the government wasn't messing with them, given supply and demand, the price would drop so low that probably all the gangs would get out of it.
Uh-huh. Now, wouldn't that be good?
Yeah.
The other thing is there's approximately $160 billion a year that goes untapped as it relates to scholarship and grant monies because our young people are perhaps not aware or others are not accessing the information. And they are encouraged to get loans instead. So I'm looking forward to your interview.
Yeah, it's coming up in a few minutes.
Oh,
yeah.
Go
ahead. Well, let me just say real quickly, Theo, that if you go to the Department of Education website, it's like you, I don't know, anyways, you can just look up U.S. Department of Education. Mm-hmm. There are, as you're saying correctly, all sorts of scholarships available. But go ahead. What was your main point?
And just simple things. There's a scholarship for people who are left-handed. Didn't say you had to be a 4.0.
Really?
Just left-handed.
Wow.
And one for folks named Allison, you know. But anyway, there is a person who calls himself a talk show host who stated, and I don't even want to call his name, that he hopes Obama fails.
Right.
What kind of American, supposedly American, would want the president to fail? Doesn't that make the country fail?
Sure.
Yeah, he is such a loser. I know who you're talking about, that guy.
It seems to me that if you want to try somebody for treason, let's try that.
Yeah, I mean, over and over again, try him.
Yeah.
Really, I know, that was ridiculous, wasn't it, Peter?
Well, I'll tell you, the guy is both an ideologue in terms of really being steeped in these far-right-wing views.
Yeah.
But he's also a showman that brings him tens of millions of dollars a year.
Yeah, controversy and inflammatory remarks, which we're known to do that here and there.
And we don't make tens of millions. We only make millions.
No, we don't, Peter.
We don't.
Because we spend. Believe us.
Yeah, if we didn't spend all our money on drugs. Are we on the air? Oh, I'm sorry. Theo, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Here, I don't know. For some reason or other, Roger is giving me this website to go to. I have no idea.
Oh, that's a federal student loan website.
Oh, okay.
FAFSA.
Yeah, it's
FASFA.
Yeah.
.org.
FASFA.org. All right. And coming up at 1 o'clock, I'm going to be doing an interview that I recorded earlier this week with someone talking about the student loan scam. I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable. Unbelievable. Here's Doug in Redford. Doug, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Good.
Let me be honest. I'm a first-time listener. So everything's about drugs tonight, so I'm going to fall right in line.
It has been kind of drug-heavy.
Yeah, exactly. The same with the commercials, as you were saying earlier on TV, about say no to drugs and whatnot. Those are usually followed by the five-hour energy shots and other, prescription pills that usually just lead to more symptoms, so you take more prescription pills.
Sure.
And what's marijuana going to lead to? Fast food?
Yeah, pretty much. maybe laziness.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe more TV, more ratings.
Wow, man. Yeah.
But, are they going to start selling cholesterol pills, too, to follow up with, a higher people eating more or being lazy? What else can they make money out of that?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, marijuana prohibition is so ingrained in our in our culture, I was going to say political culture, it's actually in our entire culture. We think of it inherently illegal. It's been illegal for, 98% of the population's lifetime.
Right.
And when you go back, a lot of us know the origins of the hysteria that preceded making it illegal when, wasn't illegal for, in fact, heroin. You could get over-the-counter drugs with heroin in the 19th century. And the law, just like, and it seems so simple because everyone knows that the prohibition against alcohol, that period, gave rise to widespread law-breaking by average citizens who did everything they could to get their hands on booze and created these criminal mobs, many of whose origins began during that period that still exists today. Just continues on like none of this information is out there. I don't get it. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, all right, you guys are having a good show.
Hey, yeah, thanks for being a first-time listener and caller. Here's Maurice from Detroit. Maurice, hi.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Good. Aren't you going to ask how Jalene is?
Hi, Jalene.
Where's the love?
I love you, Jalene.
Oh, I love you too, Maurice.
You know what I say?
What?
This country needs to close all its foreign bases. Billions of dollars you spend on war materials, and preparing for war is never going to happen because the head of butt is over in minutes.
Hey, what's that noise?
Oh, that's the me in the car.
The what?
Me in the car.
It's him in the car.
What are you doing?
And what don't you think, why do we have bases around the world for what?
It's called empire.
Yeah, how many hundreds of bases do we have here?
Ron Paul, the Republican, said I think it was like 700.
700, yeah.
Yeah. And that's where our money is. That's where our money is. Yeah, bring the bases home, bring the troops home, cut the military budget, and, we might solve a lot of our problems.
Watch. Don't drive and call, Maurice.
Okay.
It's dangerous.
You said that we picked up where the bridge left off.
You what?
We started up with the British left off on the empire around the world, trying to control the world. That's one of the reasons I can see why they're there.
That's right. There's a book, Paul Kennedy. I think it's called The Rise and Fall of the Great Empires or something like that. A conservative who shows how everybody from France and Germany and Holland and Spain, they had these periods of ascendancy where their imperial reach actually benefited the metropole, the country of origin. Oh, Rome. Oh, yeah. Can we say Rome? But eventually it just crashed everything down. Maurice, thanks for being our last caller. You have a good evening. You know, I forgot all about this. Did I send you this? The battle for the whales turns ugly on the Ross Sea. Our friends in the Sea Shepherds, Captain Paul Watson and his intrepid crew,
single-handedly stop illegal whaling
by the Japanese.
Yeah,
and they've got these fleets out there, and they follow these Japanese killer ships,
and they throw these big things of really smelly oil or something.
So now, though, that finally the Japanese are starting to get mean, and they rammed the Sea Shepherd boat, the Steve Irwin, and Paul Watson, who's nonviolent, although he's pretty militant. He's sunk whaling ships in the past,
I know,
without people on them,
right?
Yeah, and because whaling's illegal, the whole thing. I mean, how many people are for whaling?
Not me.
Not many.
I don't get it.
So we just sent them $100, by the way.
You did?
Yeah. Sea Shepherds. Let me see. It's singular, right? SeaShepherd.org.
I had someone who wanted to buy a CD, of one of my CDs, and, it's been out for a while. I'm still selling them on CD Baby, and this is not a shameless plug for myself, but I said, don't worry about it. I'll just send it to you. And he said, tell me what organization you want me to donate to next time, I'm donating. And so I said Sea Shepherd.
You know, a shameless, a shameless
plug.
We should have a plug without shame. I didn't even know you could still get your CD.
You can. CDBaby.com.
CDBaby.com.
Jalene Jordan.
J-U-L-I-N-E.
Yeah,
like
you can hear my stuff there. You can hear me on Facebook. And mostly MySpace. I tend to send people to MySpace. I'm kind of keeping the Facebook kind of a little more private.
Okay. Well, if you go to my site.
And no Republicans.
Need a plug.
I don't watch your business.
All right. With that, Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Roger, for getting the phones for us.
And we'll be back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Celebrate 38 years of rock history.
With the cool stuff you just can't get anywhere else. Get all the details now at WRIF.com.
This is the Motor City Madhouse, and I'm Ted Nugent. Happy anniversary to the Riffmaster.
The Riff.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret that credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
And motorhomes from 46,000, plus manufacturer rebates and on-site.
101.1 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I don't know, this will sound like I'm 110 years old, but when I went to college, it really wasn't very expensive. I went to Michigan State, and then I went to Wayne State University in Detroit as well. And I didn't rack up any big debt or anything like that. It was actually college fees, dormitory fees, all of that was pretty manageable. I think almost all of you know that now college is very expensive, and many of you and many people in your family leave with a student loan debt. And I often wondered, how in the world can a middle-class family even afford one student, let alone two? But there's so much more to it. And in this time of these bubbles where there's crisis after crisis, here's one that went right below the radar. And that's the student loan scam. That's the title of a brand new book by Alan Michael Collins. And what is really incredible to me, and I am so anxious to find out about this, its subtitle is The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History. Get that. Well, Alan Michael Collins is the founder of the Political Action Committee, StudentLoanJustice.org, and he earned engineering degrees from the University of Southern California. He lives in University Place, Washington, where we're reaching him. He's appeared on 60 Minutes. He's written for lots of papers like the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun. He's quoted regularly in the New York Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the Washington Post. And let's welcome him to the Peter Werby Show. Alan Michael Collins, welcome to the broadcast.
Hello, Peter. Good to be with you.
Well, I bet you have a personal story as to why you got motivated, into this whole idea of this book and why the student loan scam is the most oppressive debt in U.S. history. That boggles the imagination. Give us a personal story to start with us and go from the micro to the macro.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I, as you said, I have degrees in engineering from USC.
I had originally borrowed about $38,000 to make it through graduate school, which, believe it or not, is less than average these days. So after graduation, I got a fairly good job at California Institute of Technology as a scientist, but I left that job shortly before September 11th, 2001. So I found myself sort of unemployed, underemployed for about a year and a half. Well, I requested from my lender, who just happened to be Sally Mae, what's known as a forbearance, which allows you to suspend payments on your loan for a period of time until you can get back on your feet financially. Well, instead of granting me the forbearance, they instead put my loan into default. And from that point on, it's just been a roller coaster of penalties and fees and escalations. You know, about 14 months after I had put in my request for this forbearance, my original, what had begun as an original $38,000 in loans, had skyrocketed to over $80,000.
And $80,000? You might as well have done better to have borrowed from the mob.
Oh, well, yeah, you're not kidding. And what really got me was I had been speaking to them. I was like, you know, this is just really almost criminal what you're charging me on these fees. And I mean, you're really making me tempted to just file for bankruptcy. And I came to find out later that, in fact, student loans are non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. In fact, student loans are the only loan in U.S. history to be exempted from standard bankruptcy protections. And so at that point, I decided to do some research into the industry and see what I was dealing with here. And so I spent the next literally 3 years from what began as sort of a personal quest doing research on the industry. And I came to find out enough to write a book about it, which is The Student Loan Scam. Not only are student loans the only loan in our nation's history to be exempted from standard bankruptcy protections, but other basic standard consumer protections that we take for granted with every other type of loan, credit cards, payday loans, they don't exist for student loans. So statutes of limitations don't exist for student loans. The ability to refinance the debt. There may be a lender out there willing to give a better deal on your student loan, but if you've already consolidated, then you are stuck with whatever lender you consolidated with for the life of the loan. Truth in lending requirements have been, again, congressionally legislated away for student loans and only for student loans. So in addition to all these consumer protections that were taken, Congress also gave the industry really draconian and, as you said, mafia-like collection powers for the collection of not only the debt. I mean, there's you know, everybody, when you borrow money, obviously you need to pay it back with interest. But it's these penalties and fees that just exploded, and Congress gave the industry powers to literally seize people's paychecks, their income tax returns, even their Social Security and their disability income, all without a court order. And typically, I mean, this is done full on a very large scale across the country. The borrowers simply have no recourse. There's no negotiation available to the borrowers because all the standard consumer protections that I mentioned had been taken away.
Let me interrupt just for a second here.
Sure.
And ask, is this in part done because there was a low return on the student loans? I mean, because I have to tell you, in honesty, I don't know how it ever resolved itself, but I know a number of people that said, oh, yeah, I owe $15,000. I'm never paying them back. I mean, an extraordinary number of people who would never say that about their house mortgage or their car payment or
right.
Something like that.
Yeah, the premise for sort of tweaking the bankruptcy protections and other protections initially was, yeah, these stories of, you know, students that would graduate from college and very promptly file for bankruptcy on their debt. And this was promulgated by the student loan industry and repeated over and over and over again in the media. And you know, Congress was quick to act and to take away these very basic consumer protections. In hindsight, however, it turned out that the actual story was far different. It turned out that when student loans were fully dischargeable, like every other type of loan, in bankruptcy, in fact, far less than 1% of federally guaranteed loans were discharged through bankruptcy. That's a much better percentage than other types of consumer debt.
It probably says a lot for my friends.
Yeah, you hung out with a bad group there, I think. But, no, in fact, this was a crisis that, as one congressman at the time put it, it was a crisis that only existed in the minds of the student loan industry. And,
why do they have so much clout? I mean, how are they able to stranglehold on Congress? Usually it's about contributions to a reelection or election funds.
Well, it's an interesting story. Congress created this entity called Sallie Mae back in 1972. This is a quasi-governmental agency, for lack of a better word, that was set up specifically to repurchase student loans from banks to make make it more of a liquid market and encourage banks to lend. Well, and so obviously, Sallie Mae, being a creature of Washington, D.C., had extraordinary influence on Congress. Well, in 1995, Sallie Mae privatized from the government and became a totally for-profit enterprise. But it inherited a lot of the clout that it had been set up with by the government initially. And then, again, yes, as you said, they certainly wasted no pennies and spared no expense in, lining the congressional coffers of the various candidates that sat on both House and Senate Education Committees and also the Finance Committee and almost every other committee you can think of that has even a remote connection to student loans. It's really quite frightening the amount of money that they have put into Congress.
It's big business. I mean, what's the size of it? What are we talking about? I'm sure it's in billions.
Oh, it's
right?
A huge business. I'm not sure when you went to school, but student loans barely existed back in, let's say the 70s and 60s. Today, as a nation, collectively, we owe about $600 billion in student loan debt.
Really?
Yeah, it's an astonishing number. It's
that's
almost
amazing.
The same size as what we owe as a nation for our credit card debt.
Yeah.
And it's been growing exponentially. And here's another point that I think is very important. And I'm speaking on behalf of the borrowers who have fallen victim to this predatory system that makes it more profitable for the industry when students fall behind. But actually, I am fighting the fight for not only the borrowers, but also people who never borrowed a dime to go to college, but yet are stuck paying the price of tuition.
And, wait a minute, how's that?
Well, the thing is, this lending industry has caused massive inflation within universities and colleges across the country. In fact, since Sallie Mae was created, the price of tuition has risen at about double the rate of inflation every single year. So today, people that don't borrow, they're paying $30,000-$40,000 for their kids to go to school, private school for 1 year. Those costs are just astonishing.
Yeah, I don't understand, actually, as I said in the introduction, how a middle-class family can send one, let alone two, kids to college. The prices are just extraordinary.
Yeah, I think at this point it's fair to say that the wheels have pretty much come off the wagon. The universities have abused the power that they had, and they raised the tuition far above what any reasonable, nonprofit enterprise like a university should be allowed to raise them at. And not only that, the colleges have fallen prey to the student loan industry. They've become collusive with the industry. In fact, I was on 60 Minutes a couple of years ago, and shortly after that aired, Attorney General Elliot Spitzer of New York, and then his successor Andrew Cuomo, launched an investigation into relationships between universities and lenders. And it turned out that there was a vast network of collusion going on between the universities and the lenders, where university financial aid administrators were receiving kickbacks from the student loan companies. And not only the administrators, but the institutions as well. So it was a very dirty game of pool that the Attorney General uncovered.
It's a terrific. Let me just reintroduce you, Alan.
Sure.
It's an appropriate named book, The Student Loan Scam, the most oppressive debt in U.S. history. And this will definitely keep you listening. And the other part of the subtitle is, and how we can fight back. And we'll get to that in just a few minutes with Alan Michael Collins. This is the Peter Werbe Show. And you can go to Alan's website, which is studentloanjustice.org. Like if you're getting out of the car or something right now, studentloanjustice.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And so you have this situation, though, where people will call the financial aid staff of a university thinking they're going to get help because they want to get their kids in school. The universities want the children of the family. And but they're kind of they don't realize the full game that's going on, do they?
Well, you know, it's really funny you should mention. It turned out that in many instances when students made that phone call to the financial aid office, the person who picked up the phone on the other end was actually an employee of a student loan company. And so, you know, it was very hard to tell where the colleges left off and where the lenders began. And, you know, since that time there's been some legislation to do away with the most obvious of the transgressions. But even today, you know, we can only expect that there are some very cozy relationships going on. And it certainly does not serve the interests of the student.
Hey, what happened to you? You said your $38,000 loan had ballooned with interest to $80,000. Has it stopped there? Do you still owe it?
Oh, no. $80,000 was only like shortly, maybe a little more than a year after they had put my loan into default. By 2005, the amount had escalated to well over $100,000. And this, I should note, this is despite my best efforts to deal with whoever was holding my loan through that time period. I offered to repay the amount that I had originally borrowed, plus the interest that it accrued up until the time of default. So that includes every dollar that the federal government paid for my loan. It includes a boatload of profit for the lenders. And to this point, I've been declined at every step in the way.
So you still owe it?
Yes, that's right. I'm a debtor, just like everybody who will be reading my book, more than likely.
Well,
that's right.
Aren't they going to come after you? I mean, aren't they going to sue you and then garnish you your wages? And
well, you know, it's a funny thing. What happens with student loan debtors is the following. I mean, they largely either they pay a hugely increased cost, like double or triple the amount they borrowed, or if they refuse or are unable to pay the massively increased amount, for all intents and purposes, they're sort of forced off the grid. So,
What do you mean? What do you mean forced off the grid?
Well, they can't get a job for any length of time until, you know, either the Department of the Education or the student loan companies come and start garnishing, you know, 25% of their wages.
Have you tried to buy a home in the last few years since you've owed this?
I actually was able to buy a $70,000 home in 2004.
Because oftentimes before they'll grant a mortgage, they demand.
Well, I wasn't able to go through a conventional bank. I had to get a private loan from a private citizen.
Okay.
So I was paying 13% interest on this home mortgage for.
Alan, I'm telling you, I got to introduce you to some mafia guys here. You're going to get better rates for it all.
I'm sure the folks over there can do me a far better deal.
What did you say? I forgot again. Was it $600 billion in student loans outstanding?
That's right.
Yeah,
$600 billion.
So we're talking about, these 800-pound gorillas. Well, there's three of them really in the room right now. One is all the money we're spending on the Iraq war and occupation, really, just now, and the Afghan war. The other one is the credit card debt. But here we have the student loan, as you call it, the name of your book, the student loan scam, lurking there as well, and as jobs begin to disappear, people are going to not be able to meet their obligation. This is has a real potential for being something that none of us have are even on our radar.
Yeah, you know, that's right, and I'm sorry to throw another another log on the fire, but there is a very clear similarity between between what happened in the home mortgage industry and what, frankly, has been happening in the student loan industry for years. You know, there's an environment where you have this government guarantee standing behind the loan, and you have the private business community, the lending interests, basically gone wild, heaping as much debt as possible onto these borrowers for these assets. You know, this also is accompanied by huge inflation, as we saw in the home mortgage industry, a very horrible record of oversight on the part of the Department of Education, or, you know, I guess it would be housing and urban development in the case of the home mortgage industry. So the parallels are just straight down the line. The only difference, though, is that in the home mortgage industry, at the end of the day, the borrowers, you know, if worst comes to worst, well, you know, they can pack up, they can file for bankruptcy, and, you know, they can walk away and get a fresh start. And that's, you know, a horrible outcome, don't get me wrong. But compared to the student loan industry, that's a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
In the student loan industry, not only is the misfortunate borrower stuck with, you know, the principal, which I could see maybe, but the loan typically will have exploded to double, triple, or often quadruple, or even more than what was originally borrowed. And so there simply are no options for student loan borrowers. And, you know, it sounds like it, if you don't have student loans, you wouldn't understand. But if you have student loans, particularly defaulted student loans, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
You're talking about, 10 million people. You talk about that in your book, The Student Loan Scam, the most oppressive debt in U.S. history and how we can fight back. Alan Michael Collins is the author. He's my guest. You can go to studentloanjustice.org. And yeah, it's a bummer to owe money and all that. But, I don't mean to toss it off like that, because you say in the book, one day at the age of 33, I soberly recognized that my hopes for marriage, children, and a home were much farther away from being realized than they had been when I was 29, solely because of my mushrooming student loan debt. Is it? And you talk to a lot of people from around the country whose lives have been disrupted or ruined, and even one who became a student loan refugee. Talk a little about yourself. Has any of this been resolved? And tell us about the student loan refugee as well.
Sure. And you know, the sort of the emotional state that high levels of inescapable debt can you know, cause to a person are, you know, pretty extreme. I started Student Loan Justice in 2005 and have been, you know, collecting members and stories and so on since then. We've got over 4,000 people in our group now, and you know, we have people who have literally fled the country. In fact, we've got between 2 and 3 dozen people who have fled the country solely as a result of their exploded defaulted student loan debt. We've got people who, you know, I mean, most of the members have suffered a lot of the same, you know, emotional, you know, feelings that I mentioned in terms of, you know, either being a stress on an existing marriage or being, you know, a preventative force for getting married and having a family and so on and so forth. And in fact, there's a recent study through the U.S. Public Interest Research Groups called Paying Back, Not Giving Back, and it details a lot of consequences that student loan debt is having on our nation as a whole. And among those are people are putting off marriage and children until much later ages as a result of this debt.
Let's do this, though, and I'm sorry to interrupt you from time to time, but I want to make sure that we get, because people would go, whoa, more bad news. This is bad news. The book is Student Loan Scam, the most oppressive debt in U.S. history. But then the second half of the subtitle, the book by Alan Michael Collins, is And How We Can Fight Back. So let's address that. It sounds like they've got you by the cojones.
Well, you know, they do and they don't. I mean, we have a very strong argument on our side. I mean, there is no other debt instrument, no other type of loan in the nation's history, federally guaranteed or not, to have all the consumer protections that I mentioned removed. Now, Congress did this, and Congress, frankly, shouldn't have done it. And people who are expert in this field and unbiased will acknowledge that there really was no premise for doing this in the first place. And we're seeing the human suffering, truly the human misery that's resulting from this lack of consumer protections. So it should be fairly easy for Congress to simply restore the consumer protections that it took away. You know, that's certainly it takes a congressional action, but it's certainly within the realm of Congress's power to do. And so clearly, it is time for Congress to end this failed experiment, return standard consumer protections to student loans, and approach the problem from that basis.
Is it on the agenda? Do you have the ear of any congresspeople or senators?
Well, you know, we do. As a matter of fact, we were credited as being the inspiration for what's known as the Student Borrower Bill of Rights. This was created by Hillary Clinton in 2006 and was reintroduced again in 2007. Not only that, I would have to give high credit to Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. He's been besides Senator Kennedy, I'd say Dick Durbin has been among the foremost fighters in Congress for students.
What's the impediment, though? We're talking now. You've been talking about stuff 2 and 3 years back.
Student Borrower Bill of Rights basically languished. It didn't really go anywhere, and I don't think there was really any push behind it in the first place. It was more a piece of legislation that was meant to put it, get it out there on the map. Well, Dick Durbin also introduced legislation that would have restored bankruptcy protections for private loans, as did his colleague Danny Davis, both senator and congressman from your neighboring state of Illinois. And those two bills, well, the first was sort of quietly killed, and certainly the lobbying freight train that is the student loan industry had a lot to do with that. Danny Davis's amendment, which was very similar to Dick Durbin's, was actually voted down in committee by – sorry, it was voted down on the floor of the House by the Blue Dog Democrats, which I frankly wasn't too impressed with.
Conservative on –
Yeah, conservative Democrats. But, when they're taking money from banks – there's just, in my view, that's just wrong. I mean, if you're sitting on a finance committee or you're sitting on an education committee and you're taking money from student loan interests, that frankly is just wrong. But yet, I guess the Blue Dogs apparently have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say that unfortunately we're at the end of our interview, but fortunately you can go to Alan Michael Collins' website. It's studentloanjustice.org. Alan Michael Collins, his last name is Collinge. The book is The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back. CNN Money, just a couple months ago, said student loans have become the most profitable, uncompetitive, and oppressive type of debt in our nation's history. There's about 5 million federal student loans currently in default. This could be the next bubble to burst. I advise anyone who is in this situation, who is thinking about ever going to college, who has kids that may go to college, get this book, The Student Loan Scam, The Most Oppressive Debt in U.S. History and How We Can Fight Back by Alan Michael Collins. There'll be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Thank you so much for being on The Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be with you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Celebrate 38 years of garage history.
With the cool stuff you just can't get anywhere else. Get all the details now at WRIF.com.
What's up? This is Jacoby from P. Roach. Just want to wish you guys a happy anniversary. 101 WRIF.
No rest.
Your credit card debt is getting out of control. You're having trouble making the monthly minimums. Sound familiar? You have to do something, but what? Well, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. The mortgage brokers want you to put up your family home to pay off credit card debts. Problem is that more often than not, you find yourself using the credit cards again. Only this time there's no equity left in your home, and you have a whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years, and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. 1-866-290-8282.
I have acne. Here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. People who are sick and tired of wasting money on acne products that just don't work. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. Find out how to get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne-fighting system. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put us to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now toll-free 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt. But now, you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help get you out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I just got an email from someone the other day asking me if they were related to me. And they actually, I can just say their nickname. It was Stormy Werby. I like that, Stormy Werby. But I wrote back and said, gee, I don't know. And I realized how little I know about my family history. I know good parts of it have been here since the 19th century. Some came in the 20th century, but very, very little. And I'm always so envious of people that have this large idea of their family, history, the generations they go back. Well, it's a pleasure to bring to our microphones Larry Gabriel, who's written a book about his family. It's called Daddy Plays Old Time New Orleans Jazz. And Larry Gabriel, who's an old friend of mine, by the way, he's a writer and musician, a columnist for Detroit's Metro Times. He's a former editor of Metro Times, and what do you say for full disclosure, he edited, thankfully, edited many of the pieces that I submitted. Also, the editor of the UAW Solidarity magazine, and was a features writer and editor for the Detroit Free Press. He's won lots of awards for editing, editorial writing, and features story writing from the Michigan Press Association. And he's proud to be part of the fourth generation of family musicians in the United States. Larry Gabriel, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thanks for having me, Pete.
And so this is an amazing book. It's about the Gabriel family and those connected with it, the other parts of your family. Daddy plays old-time New Orleans jazz. Give us an idea of the title and what this is, how this traces your family roots.
Well, you know, the title actually came from a conversation I had with a jazz musician, Mr. Danny Barker. And I told him I was working on this, and Mr. Barker's actually one of the original old banjo players of New Orleans music from the early 1900s. And he's also written a couple of books himself, one of them Bourbon Street Black. And I was saying that I was going to write a book and call it Daddy Plays Old Time Music. And he told me that, well, you know, you're talking about jazz. You should always say specifically jazz if you're going to be talking about jazz. Mm-hmm. And then I thought about that, and I says, well, then I should get real specific and call it New Orleans jazz. And it's a family musical history. We got six generations of musicians in my family going back to my great-grandfather, who came to New Orleans in 1856 from Santo Domingo. And he was a bass player, and his son, my grandfather, was a musician, and all of his sons, who were my father and my uncles, were musicians. And then my generation, we got a lot of musicians in my generation, my cousins. Charlie Gabriel is one. He's a saxophonist who plays around Detroit. He actually doesn't play around Detroit much anymore. He's been on the road with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band for the last several months, and he's the fourth one of my relatives who's been in the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
Tell me about the photograph on the cover, an extraordinary cover with, well, you describe it. It's hard to describe because it's a man playing the stand-up bass, not one of those Fenders, but one of those big classical double basses, and being utilized in a way that's pretty unusual.
Well, you know, my father, that's my father in that picture.
Really?
It was taken during the 1940s when he was traveling on the road as a promotional kind of thing. But he's upside down on the chair, his foot is up on the back of the chair and his head's down towards the floor, opposite what you would normally be. And he's got his bass, he's playing his bass upside down, and it's an act he used to do when there was a famous song during the 40s, One O'Clock Jump, and sure. This was his act on One O'Clock Jump. Actually, he used to do quite a few kind of, like, you know, that show busy entertainment kind of stuff. I have a cousin who was nearly as old as my father, because my father was the youngest kid in the family, and his brother was 17 years older than him, and he started having kids right around the time my father was born. So she said, yeah, I saw Uncle Percy play the bass with his toes before.
Larry Gabriel, there's a photograph of you on the back. Most of us, middle-class folks are pretty reserved, but you've got like a tuxedo on, a sash that says jazz, and you're dancing next to a guy playing the clarinet. What is that all about?
Yeah, that's a Sibel Kodish photo that was taken for the Metro Times. But I do what is called second lining, which in New Orleans history, that's when in the funeral processions, after you have taken the body to the graveyard and you leave, the band breaks out into happy music after having played mournful hymns. And people come in who weren't part of the funeral. They become the second line, and they dance to the music in that. And that's an outfit I wear when I do the when I lead second line parades. It's I wear some Mardi Gras beads and a sash, and I have an umbrella, a parasol that I have decorated with flowers and ribbons, and I carry a white dove. Sometimes I have it on my umbrella. Sometimes it's on my shoulder. Sometimes it's in my hand. And I'm standing next to my cousin Charlie, who's playing clarinet there. And you know, we did a little photo session, and, you know, that was the one that we liked.
I love it. I never would have thought. The book is Daddy Plays Old Time New Orleans Jazz. My guest in the studio, Larry Gabriel. There's a website for it as well, gumbospot.com. We're going to talk about gumbo, maybe even hear a little poem about gumbo as our interview continues. Tell me about the impetus to begin this history. Was it all right there, or was it? Did it really take some investigation?
You know what? It didn't take a lot of investigation. What it really was putting together a lot of things from disparate places that I already knew about, but nobody had ever put it all together. For one thing, my father used to just, he was a storyteller. You know, he just told stories. And he was on the road with various bands from about 1938 to 1951. So he had a lot of stories to tell about traveling on the road. He played with the likes of Jay McShann, piano player, T-Bone Walker.
Really?
He actually did some sessions with Roy Brown, one of the seminal rock and roll shouters. He did Good Rockin' Tonight back in the late 1940s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that actually has been redone by who? The Honey Drippers, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's great. You know, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, I would have I have little knowledge of my family history, and if I had to seek out putting this back together, I think it would be really difficult. Is there anything unique in the ability to do this in an African American family, or is it just a coincidence of your family? You think that a book is filled with the stories, filled with photographs, filled with documents?
Anybody can do this sort of thing. In my family, it was unique. Again, I told you my father was a storyteller, but also the Tulane University in New Orleans, it's called the William Ransom Hogan Archive. They've done a lot of oral history interviews with jazz musicians, and they did oral history interviews with my father and a number of other family members, my uncles, my cousin. I have a cousin, Clarence Ford, who was with Fats Domino from about 1958 to 1971.
Wow.
He actually left Fats Domino at a time, I don't know if people would know this, but there was a car accident when Fats Domino's road band, a member of the band, got killed. My cousin Clarence was nearly killed, and that's when he chose never to go on the road again. But so there's a lot of this stuff that's in Tulane University. I went down to New Orleans and went to Tulane and went through a lot of the files. And then there's a lot of interviews with other people that may have mentioned I was in such and such a band, and this guy, other guy was in that band who happened to be my uncle or my, you know, cousin or something like that. And then, you know, I use the things that other people can use. There's a website, Ancestry.com, where you can go and look at census records, that sort of thing, social security records, birth and death records, that kind of thing. So a lot of the stuff that I kind of knew, I was able to go onto there and verify dates and that sort of thing.
Did you get stumped at any point?
Not really. There was probably stuff that I could have done. One thing I was stumped is I kind of looked at where my great-grandfather came. I was looking for some type of immigration record or something like that, and I could never get him, like, on a list of a ship that came in or something like that. The first note I have of him, I believe, is the 1870 census, and he was already here, so I didn't have any of that sort of thing.
And he came as a free man, so your ancestors were all freemen?
Well, he came as a free man, and he brought his wife with him. That's on my father's side. And as a matter of fact, when he came here, slavery was still in effect in the United States. He came in 1856. Slavery didn't end, I believe, until like 1864 with the Emancipation Proclamation. If it wasn't 64, it was right in that range. So I think about that, and it was like, wow, he came to this country when slavery was still going on. That's amazing.
It is indeed. The book is Daddy Plays Old Time New Orleans Jazz. Larry Gabriel is my guest. Larry, you're a native born Detroiter. Tell me about the New Orleans connection, and because you go there frequently, right?
Yeah. Although I haven't been since Katrina. I was there right before Katrina, and since then I've not been sure I wanted to go, but I'm hoping to go again this spring for the Jazz Festival.
Tell me why, though. I mean, I'm interrupting your answer.
Well, at first it was kind of the fact that there was a lot of dirt and dust, and, they were talking about the mold, and I was concerned about disease and illness going down there. And the other thing is that my cousins who do still live there have told me, right now is not the right time to come. So that's been part of it. And part of it is that, hey, I'm here doing what I do here.
Sure. You know?
But
so you were, yeah, I'm sorry, you said you hadn't been there since Katrina, and I'd asked about your New Orleans connection.
Yeah, well, my parents were born in New Orleans. As a matter of fact, all the siblings older than me were born in New Orleans. I was the first person in my family born in Detroit.
Oh.
But during the 1940s, my family members were moving to Detroit to work in the auto industry. And my father, he'd been on the road for quite some time. And my mother, you know, they had four kids at the point my father, in 1951, when my father chose to move here. They had four kids. My mother had been on his case to kind of get off the road because he was always on the road. And he was on his way to Cleveland to play a job with Danny Barker. And he stopped here in Detroit to see my uncle, who had already moved here a few years before. And my uncle, you know, kind of gave him the, you know, talking to his little brother, saying, hey, you know, you got these kids. You need to get a good job. I can get you on at the Ford plant if you move to Detroit. So Dad didn't even make the gig in Cleveland. He sent somebody else, and he stayed here and went over and got a job at Ford right off the bat.
How to get my pronunciation right. New Orleans, right? Not New Orleans. All right. New Orleans. I got it down. The book is Daddy Plays Old-Time New Orleans Jazz. Larry Gabriel, the author, is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. You can go to gumbospot.com. I'll have a link to it on my site as well, peterwerby.com. New Orleans draws you back. Why?
Well, that's where my family's from. Up until recently, I had a lot of aunts and uncles there, cousins. I still do have some cousins there. Actually, after Katrina, a number of my cousins left New Orleans and scattered to many places, many of them to Texas, some of them out to the West Coast, some of them moved east. So to us, even though I was born in Detroit, when I was a little kid, home was New Orleans.
Hmm.
You know, my mom said, well, we're going home. That meant, you know, we'd go to New Orleans. We'd go and we'd spend the summer there, you know, staying at my aunt's house. And actually, it's interesting because a lot of the people that I talk to, you know, when I say New Orleans, they get all excited and start talking about these places they went to in New Orleans and partied and all that. And for me, going to New Orleans was going to visit my aunts and uncles and cousins, and we'd go to people's houses and that sort of thing. So a lot of these things that people think of as New Orleans are things that I never experienced, because that's not what I do when I go to New Orleans.
Well, speaking of your aunt, your memoir has A Taste of New Orleans in the back, New Orleans in the back. And you have a recipe for Esther Gabriel's okra gumbo and also Aunt Vicky's shrimp creole. And the first thing I did was look in the back, and I said to my wife, we got to make these. These sound great. How come you included these?
Well, you know, when you say New Orleans, that whole culture, food, music, you know, the Creole thing, the Cajun thing, New Orleans is really like a whole different little country inside the United States. I would almost say it's sort of like a Hamtramck or a Highland Park, but with a more vibrant culture. And so, you know, I grew up eating a lot of stuff that other people would consider exotic. You know, you go to restaurants to buy this stuff, but we ate gumbo at home, you know. Red beans and rice was a regular, you know, in our house. But I'm writing this, and I'm trying to capture the essence of New Orleans and the feeling of New Orleans, you know, not just make it a dry, you know, genealogy or something. And so I threw my mother's okra gumbo recipe in the back. And actually, you know, that's why I named my publishing company Gumbo Publishing. My website is called Gumbo Spot. I actually have two gumbo recipes on my website. My mother's filet gumbo recipe and the okra gumbo recipe. And when I was a kid, I never liked okra, and I was a big fan of the filet gumbo, which was, you know, mostly meats and seafood and stuff. But as I've grown older and have learned to like my vegetables, I have moved over to the okra gumbo side.
I'm a big fan of okra as well. But both these recipes are for quite a large number of people. Is that an accident?
Well, that was my mother's recipe. You know, there was eight kids in the family, and we always, a lot of times we had relatives staying with us because, you know, we had that thing where we moved up and then other relatives would move in, move up, and they'd stay with you until they got themselves settled and move on. So there was always a lot of people around the house.
Is it unusual that there was a number of pipelines of migrations for the South from beginning in the early 20th century of African Americans, and people went to specific areas? A lot of people from Texas and would go to Los Angeles, Mississippi, and Alabama would come to Detroit. Was there a lot of that migration from New Orleans here, or are you guys kind of unusual?
There was a good amount of the migration from New Orleans here because of the car companies. People were coming here to get jobs in the car companies. There was also quite a bit to Chicago. That was the typical cliche was up the river to Chicago. That's where, you know, jazz came.
That's where the blues and jazz came, up the river from New Orleans, right? Larry Gabriel is my guest. The book is Daddy Plays Old-Time New Orleans Jazz. Gumbospot.com will bring you to the website and another couple of recipes as well, and I just made a note of that. It'll also be at peterwerby.com as well. Larry, you also include some poetry as a way of talking about your family. I wonder if you would be willing to read that one poem in there, or one of the, actually.
Okay. Well, I got a couple more than one
yeah,
poem
you
in
do.
There, but
you
there's a poem here that I'd like to read. It's about my Uncle Clarence. Uncle Clarence was what they might have said once upon a time was tetched. He was kind of an oddball. He learned how to play piano by putting his fingers on the keys of a player piano, you know, that played the piano rolls, and learn, you know, where how to play the piano through that route.
That's amazing.
And so he had a career as a piano player and as a banjo player, and which wasn't unusual for a New Orleanian. A lot of these musicians, when you go back to it, you find out that they had, you know, careers as one instrument, and then when that instrument was no longer popular, they'd switch instruments and play something else for whatever was popular. But this is called Uncle Clarence's Later Years, and my uncle became a ward of my aunt at one point, and she was his guardian, and he lived in the back of her house. And there's one of these, the photograph I have in here. I know this is radio, but this photo is kind of one of those accidental great art pictures that's just kind of a snapshot. And it's a picture of him sitting on the side of the bed in the room at the back of the house watching TV. And you can see his pants hanging on the wall. And there's a clock under the TV. You can see what time it is. And it's just a beautiful picture. Uncle Clarence's later years. Uncle Clarence didn't talk much. He just played that music in the back room of Aunt Berta's house. In the old days, he'd rap that banjo with the best, played guitar and ragtime piano like a man on a mission. One time, he went wild and nearly killed a man. Instead of jail, he was exiled to the back of Alberta and August's house to stay out of trouble. He sat back there with a gleam in his eyes, music on his mind, and notes under his fingers. Played his way right back to 1925 and disappeared, like an unresolved note in the Louisiana sun.
That's nice. It is indeed. I wonder, too, because although we just talked about this at the beginning of Chapter 10, the Gabriel brothers in Motown, we were just talking about the up north migration from New Orleans, and the poem is called Migration, in fact. Go ahead.
Migration. They came north, like so many others, to work on Mr. Ford's assembly line, for a union job and a steady paycheck. They came north with music that kept them going day after day in the grinding din of factory death. Punched the clock out and headed for the bandstand. That's how it had always been. Punch the clock and head for the music. A cool drink of water. Something to look for on all those sundowns between the birth and death days.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, Larry Gabriel. You mentioned earlier about having not been back to New Orleans since Katrina. Actually, I thought you were going to say something different. I mean, I wonder if part of the reticence is some about fear of how much it may have changed with that devastation that it experienced.
You know what? New Orleans will never be the same place that it once was. And particularly the New Orleans that I knew. The French Quarter, that didn't get flooded. You know, all the clubs are still there. You know, most of the tourist attraction type things. But, you know, when I used to go to New Orleans, again, I'd visit my family members in the neighborhoods of New Orleans. And some of those neighborhoods are the places that got destroyed. And it's a very painful thing for some people. I have an aunt who, you know, she got money to get her house fixed because the water was up to the eaves of her house, and she paid a contractor, and the contractor disappeared with her money. Oh. You know, I have another cousin who's very elderly. I have a lot of cousins who are much older than me, again, because my father was the youngest kid in the family, who's been living in a trailer on the front lawn of her house, you know, trying to get her house fixed. You know, so that kind of thing is, you know, doesn't make it easy to go back and see what's going on. And, you know, just, excuse me, so many things that are different. They're not going to be there.
Well, I wonder, at one point I was toying with the idea of writing a history of the era in the 60s and the 70s, and my wife said, you know, you're going to wind up with a lot of people hating you. So I wonder, how does your family, how many members have read Daddy Plays Old Time New Orleans Jazz, and how have they reacted to it?
You know, they've reacted pretty well. When I was a kid, my father used to tell me, you're a Gabriel, you know, be proud of that. That's something. And that's something that's pervasive through our family. And like I said, you know, we've got all these stories that have been floating around. And I felt like, you know, I'm the writer in the family. I need to pull all this stuff together because we're going to lose it. Because, you know, as the generations, you know, move on and people scatter, used to be when we first moved to Detroit, everybody moved to the same neighborhood. So there was, you know, a couple of hundred people within like a 3 mile square area.
What area was it?
We lived on the west side of Detroit, generally near Warren and West Grand Boulevard, going over to what was then Myrtle, which is now Martin Luther King, off of, like, you know, 16th Street, 17th Street, that area, Linwood.
Let me, because we've got about only about a minute left, let me let you finish about how family members responded. Nobody said, I can't believe you told that out in public about Uncle so-and-so.
Well, no, everybody knows it. You know, nobody really says it, but I actually came out and said it. Nobody got upset, you know. But, you know, they love the book. All these pictures I had to gather from family members, you know, everybody who had something to do with it was happy to contribute, and I've been getting a lot of family members calling me up, wanting the book.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, Larry Gabriel, thank you so much for being with us. Herb Boyd, a Detroiter, an old friend of both of ours, author of Baldwin's Harlem, a biography of James Baldwin, said few families in jazz provide such an unbroken evolution of the music as the Gabriels. And Larry Gabriel has done a magnificent job of framing their contributions within this context. And this study is another important addition to understanding the foundation of jazz. Blow Gabriels. That's a great little line at the end. Larry, well, let's give one more time the website. It's gumbospot.com, and also a couple of recipes in addition to the ones in the book. It's a tremendous book with and designed, we should say, by Barbara Bearfield, who has done a magnificent job.
Oh, she's beautiful.
And also there'll be a link at my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Larry Gabriel, thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best Rip Rock.
The way you want it.
On the Rock.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Let's get down to some direct talk from DirecTV. At a time when the cost of almost everything around you is spiraling out of control, DirecTV puts you back in control with this amazing offer. Right now, you can get over 150 digital channels of DirecTV for just $29.99 a month for a full year. For a limited time, ask how to get 3 free months of HBO, Stars, and Showtime. That's 28 of the best premium movie channels free for 3 whole months. Lock in your savings by switching to DirecTV. Call 888-359-5566. Call right now to get over 150 digital channels of DirecTV, just $29.99 a month for a full year. Call 888-359-5566. That's 888-359-5566. Offer ends 3309, subject to credit approval. $23 bill credit requires rebate and enrollment in auto bill pay program. New DirecTV customers only. Lease and credit card required. Other conditions apply. Call for details.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I've got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is now 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad your credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe the slate clean once and for all. Call right now and I'll rush you my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
Do you know the difference between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now, 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
Back to the Rock.
101.
W-I-S. The Riff.
Now maybe, did I mean to treat you bad, yeah, but I did anyway, now maybe, some would say your life was safe, yeah, but you lived it anyway, so maybe, your friends will stand around you, watch you crumble. As you fall to the ground, and then someday your friends will stand beside as you will fly. Oh, you will fly and oh so high. But then someday people look at you and what they call their own. They watch you suffer. Yeah, here you're coming home. And then someday we can take our time to brush the leaves.